You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. It is my great privilege to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Victoria Law, who is a freelance journalist focusing on women's incarceration. She is the author of Resistance Behind Bars, The Struggles of Incarcerated Women, which I highly recommend, and co-author of Your Home is Your Prison, coming out next year. Since 2003, she has edited Tenacious, Art and Writings by Women in Prison. She recently published an article in These Times magazine called Corporations Are Profiting from Immigrant Detainees' Labor. Some say it's slavery. Her website is victorialaw.net. Victoria Law, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. Thanks for doing the work you're doing. Let me start with an obvious question. Do you say it's slavery?
Well, I say that any work that is obtained by fraud, force, or coercion, which is, you know, what people have been alleging against these private prison corporations, indeed is slavery, because people are not free to leave. They're not free to decide not to work without huge consequences. So yes, I don't want to minimize the horrors of slavery, of U.S. slavery. So I prefer not to use the term, because obviously people are not being lashed and having their children ripped from them and being forcibly bred. But at the same time, people who are not allowed to leave, who are forced to work and have no recourse in sight, very much are under these conditions.
Right. I sometimes have talked about the volunteer military in the United States as the one voluntary thing you're not allowed to quit volunteering for, but that isn't true, is it? These volunteer work programs in prison, not exactly volunteer, are they?
They are not. As my article points out, people are, while the program is called the Voluntary Work Program, and ICE defines it as people are given the opportunity to volunteer to work for $1 per day wages, they actually, in many cases, are not actually volunteering, because if they try to take a day off, if they try to say no to working, if they try to say no to working unreasonable hours or unreasonable shifts, like one person was threatened with being moved to a more dangerous housing unit when he was woken up at 2 a.m. and told to work the 2 a.m. shift instead of the 10 a.m. shift. It actually is not voluntary. It actually is coercive.
And these types of programs are not just the property of ICE. I mean, this is something that goes on in similar form in other U.S. And state prisons in the United States, right?
Yes. People in jails and prisons are often used, their labor is often used to keep the prisons and the jails going. So they end up having to do things like mop the floors, cook for the other people who are incarcerated inside, work in, say, a prison barber shop, mow the lawns, maintain the grounds. So these are all jobs that if you had to pay somebody on the outside minimum wage, even if it was just minimum wage, you would end up, the jail, the prison, or the immigrant detention center would end up spending thousands, not hundreds of thousands of dollars on these same jobs. But if you can coerce somebody who is incarcerated within to work for either $1 a day or 20 cents an hour, or in some cases, people are not paid at all, but they are allowed a few extra privileges, like maybe being able to go out to the yard or to the law library, or getting a little bit of extra food in exchange for their labor,
yeah,
the facility can save so much money. And it's also a way to keep people occupied so that they're not just sitting there thinking about causing trouble.
So is a profit interest driving such programs, and is a profit interest driving incarceration policy so that prisons that are providing women to work on farms, for example, are making mm-hmm. sure those prison beds are full with potential workers?
Well, I think in the case of private prison corporations, the profit motive is huge because they are corporations. At the end of the day, they are beholden to their shareholders. They need to show their shareholders that they're bringing in, you know, much more revenue than they are putting out, that their profit is great. So, again, if you can pay, if you don't have to pay hundreds of people to do these jobs of, like, cooking and cleaning and all the other maintenance type of things, and you can instead only have to pay for security staff, maybe basic medical staff, maybe something else, then you can turn around to your shareholders and say, we have, you know, we have X amount of revenue and we're not putting out that much in labor costs. For example, the Stewart Detention Center in Lumpkin, Georgia, which is one of the private immigrant detention centers, which is currently being sued for forced labor, employs 300 outside employees, 300 for over 1,000 people detained, because they can actually use detained people's labor to do things like cooking. How many people would you have to employ to cook for over 1,000 people? How many people would you have to employ to clean the toilets and clean the floors and do the laundry for over 1,000 people if you had to pay minimum wage for each and every one of those jobs? That would cut into your profit margins quite a bit. At the same time, I want to caution listeners against thinking that it's just profit that drives mass incarceration, because while jails and prisons and immigrant detention centers often cut costs, such as labor costs or food costs, or, you know, like the cost of paying employees or providing a law library or doing all sorts of other, you know, necessities, profit isn't the main motivator for mass incarceration. It's a way to get people who are considered undesirable off the streets, out of their homes, their communities, and also to prevent people from organizing and mobilizing around social injustices and social oppressions. And then there is the added bonus where if they land in, say, a private prison corporation, or if a private company can contract with a publicly run prison, as we see in many state-run prisons, there's just the added bonus that somebody can profit off of their misery and oppression.
Are there other less rational motivations, including sadism? I mean, what's your view of the incredible cruelty that's been in the news recently of immigrant families being ripped apart, children being taken from parents? Who does that protect from anything?
It doesn't protect anyone from anything. I mean, maybe it protects children from being around loving parents and traumatizes them for life, if you wanted to protect them from having a trauma-free life. But I think that there's a notion that people come, there's a xenophobic notion that has been fanned over the past several years. You know, like, it obviously precedes the current president and the current administration, you know, but he rode this xenophobia into office, where people believe that if you try to enter this country, you get what you deserve, in the same way that people think that if you are accused of committing a crime, you don't even have to be found guilty, but you can be accused of committing a crime and end up in jail awaiting your day in court, and you suffer unspeakable horrors and injustices, such as, you know, being brutalized, being denied medical care, having your life threatened, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Somehow it's your own moral failing and your own moral shortcoming, and it doesn't look at a broader picture of what is happening in society, whether it be inside the U.S. society, in terms of racism, economic inequality, racial profiling, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, or if you are coming from a country which U.S. policy has decimated over years and years, if not decades, that have forced a person to flee their home country, leave everyone that they know and that they love, and try to seek safety in the United States. But there's a notion that somehow you get what you deserve. And so if you didn't want to, say, have your baby ripped away from you at the border, you should have stayed where you were and faced threats of violence and death,
yeah,
rather than coming to this country that's been held out as this beacon of hope.
And the baby should have made wiser decisions as well, I suppose.
Yes. I mean, like this kind of, there's a moral discrepancy in that we care about some babies and we don't care about others. And we can see that in the reactions, in people's reactions to families being forcibly separated at the border.
Indeed. We're speaking with Victoria Law, whose books include Resistance Behind Bars, The Struggles of Incarcerated Women. And this is a book that gives a great overview of the state of U.S. incarceration of women and of how some of those women are trying to resist. How many women are locked up now in the United States, and how does their incarceration compare with that of men?
So incarcerated women make up roughly 10, maybe 12% of the incarcerated population in jails and prisons. So this is not counting women who are in immigrant detention centers, who are off, because immigrant detention centers are counted differently when you start putting all the numbers together. So they make up 10, maybe 12%. There are over 200,000 women behind bars, so that's in jails, awaiting trial. You know, they've been accused but not convicted, or they're serving very short sentences that only require them to be in a jail, like, say, less than 12 months, or in state or federal prisons. So there are 2.2 million people behind bars. There are maybe 215,000, 220,000 of them are in women's jails and prisons. I also want to note that there are trans women in men's jails and prisons across the country, and nobody knows how many transgender women there are behind bars because nobody keeps track of this statistic. Jails and prisons often don't count them. They often refuse to acknowledge that there are trans women in their facilities. So we don't have an idea of that. So you think of 214,000 women in women's jails and prisons, plus an unknown number of trans women in men's jails and prisons who are not being counted.
Reading your book, which looks at how women have tried to organize and demand better treatment in various areas, including relations with young children and medical care and education and so forth, you know, I'm struck first by the fact that so many of these women lack basic education, and you write that about half have suffered past physical or sexual abuse. These are women who weren't given much of a chance in the first place.
Yes. I mean, prisons are a place where people who have the least amount of resources and the least amount of opportunities and are often Black, brown, immigrant, and unable to access those resources and opportunities, even by this meritocracy that we have, because of the color of their skin and the racism that prevails in our society, then are criminalized either because they are surviving on criminalized means, such as, you know, street-based sex work, you know, or small drug dealing, but they're not actually given opportunities, or they might be involved in relationships in which they get caught up in somebody else's illegal actions. And again, we see the U.S. Legal system punishing those who have the least. And in cases like federal drug conspiracy cases, so we have the recent case of Alice Johnson, the 61-year-old grandmother who was sentenced to life without parole in the federal system, who was recently given a commutation and released from prison by the president, which was astounding. But in 1991, she was arrested as part of a drug conspiracy, and her role was the woman that passed along messages. So somebody called her and said, hey, you know, I'm in town. And she would then say, great. And she would call the local drug dealer and say, so-and-so is in town. And the drug dealer would say, well, tell him to meet me on the corner of X and Y. The other person would call her back, and she would pass along that message. And for that, she got money. And the reason why she started doing that is because she had been laid off from her job the year before. It was a job that had paid her benefits. It was a job that allowed her to support her family of three children and herself. And she had gotten a new job at someplace else, and it didn't pay her enough to make ends meet. So as a single mother who was Black, living in the South with not a lot of job opportunities, when somebody came along and said, how would you like to make some easy money? You don't have to handle drugs. You don't have to see anybody. You know, you're basically kind of not put in any sort of danger. You know, she said yes.
Yeah.
And when everybody was arrested, she had the least amount of knowledge to be able to trade for a lesser sentence. So in the way that the criminal legal system works, oftentimes the prosecutors will come and they will arrest you. And if you are able to say, hey, I can give you the drug kingpins above me, or I can give you the names of everybody in my network, you can bargain that down for a lesser charge and a lesser sentence. Alice Johnson did not have that as the person who just passed along phone messages for a few hundred dollars to keep a roof over her kid's head and food on the table. So she ended up not being able to parlay that into a deal and got life without parole. And in the federal prison system, there actually is no parole. So I apologize, I misspoke, but
sure. It
is a life sentence is a life sentence unless by some miracle some president decides to issue you clemency. So when we think about Alice Johnson and this and the fact that her sentence was commuted and she was allowed to go home, we have to think about the fact that there are hundreds of other people in similar situations whose names we don't know and who don't have big name celebrities going and lobbying for their freedom.
Indeed. A lot of your book and what you write in your book you think has been insufficiently paid attention to heretofore is how women in prison in many cases take steps to try to improve their conditions a little bit. Can you talk about some examples of what can be done after you're locked up?
Yes. So, for example, we talk about you just mentioned the fact that so many women have had or have not had access to a lot of formal education. Their literacy level is not super great. Their formal education level is not great. This does not mean that they are stupid or dumb, but it may mean that when they are given a form that is in either legalese or medicalese, they may not understand what this means. They may not be able to parse out things that people learn, that many people learn while they are in school, like how to read a document, you know, how to be able to make heads or tails out of this. So say if you go to a doctor and your literacy level is not great, and the way that you describe things is my tummy hurts rather than I have an ache, you know, in my abdomen and it feels like this and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The doctor might say you have a tummy ache, drink some water and go away. Not, you know, like, hey, you've been having this sharp blinding pain in your abdomen for the past 3 weeks, and this is what happens, you know, like when you do X, Y, or Z, maybe let's look into whether or not it's A, B, or C. So
yeah.
Women have organized to teach each other how to advocate for better medical care, because in prisons, both publicly run prisons and private prisons, medical care is atrocious. It's often substandard. It's often inadequate. Women often have women and men. I don't want to say that men are having this wonderful healthcare system in their prisons, because they are not. But people in prisons often face huge barriers to actually getting to medical care in the first place, whether it's that the guard does not want to escort them down to the medical office. Unlike what you see in, say, shows like Orange is the New Black, people don't actually get to wander around the prison. of their own accord. You need to be issued a pass to go from point A to point B. So if you want to go from your dormitory or your cell to the medical unit, a guard must write you a pass that says, you know, Alice Johnson is allowed to go from her cell to the medical unit at 11 a.m. If the guard decides that they don't want to give you that pass, too bad, so sad for you, you're not seeing the doctor.
Right.
So women have banded together to help teach each other, like, what kinds of questions to ask, how to formulate their complaints, how to read test results, especially if you have a chronic illness such as hepatitis or HIV, and you may not understand what are these results. Understanding what kinds of questions to ask, too, if you are diagnosed with something like HIV or hepatitis, which are chronic illnesses and diseases that are not taught most people in schools. Like, hey, this is what you do if you find out that you're HIV positive. These are the questions to ask. These are the kinds of medications that you might want to be asking for, type of thing. So it's sharing that kind of very crucial information with each other and helping each other stay alive.
Yeah.
And it's not the kind of sexy uprising or rebellions or work strikes that catch media attention, but it is a very life-saving
type of
organizing.
In the book, you do talk about hunger strikes, among other things, of lawsuits, filing grievances, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
I'm interested in it. You also say that in some cases, getting word out of a prison and into the media and into the public is more effective than filing a grievance or a lawsuit. And you've worked with women in prison to tell their stories. What kind of hurdles do they face in trying to speak publicly about conditions inside a prison?
Well, oftentimes it's trying to even get a hold of the media. So unlike people on the outside, people in prisons don't have access to the internet as we know it. Some prisons have a very limited form of email, or maybe e-messaging would be a better form of saying it. So in which you can go to a kiosk and you can send a message for, you know, like 30 cents or 40 cents to somebody who has already approved you to contact them. So basically,
right,
like a random person in prison cannot say, get a hold of my email address and just email me. I would have to say, like, yes, I allow this person to contact me, and then they would be able to
and
send
pay
me a
money
message via this email. Yes, and pay money. But they don't have access to the internet to be able to say, like, how would I find sympathetic reporters who might cover what's going on in here?
Right.
So first of all, there's not that wide access to information. And then there are, you know, like challenges of sending things out via either postal mail or this e-messaging, which often has security scanners in which basically, there's like a keyword search that can be written into the program so that say things like hunger strike, work strike, you know, rebellion, you know, like there are keywords, escape, can all be like flagged. And then somebody actually will like pause the message. It won't go out immediately. And a staff member reads the message to see what exactly the message says. So it could be like the word escape. It might be like, hey, you know, like what I've been doing to escape this reality is doing yoga.
Right.
Fine. Good. You know, but it might be like, hey, my escape plot is blah, blah, blah. But it also means then that if people are saying, you know, this medical care is atrocious and three people have been diagnosed with X, but really they were misdiagnosed and Y happened and this, that, and the other, it's very difficult to get that kind of information out. At the same time, if you don't get that information out, people don't know what's happening inside jails and prisons. And as we know, with all things, you know, all injustices, if there is no light shined on it, then it just continues,
right,
unabated.
I'm struck when in reading your book, Resistance Behind Bars, that a lot of what women end up doing, organizing better educational programs and so forth, seems to be what people sometimes imagine or used to imagine prisons were for in the first place. I mean, they're still called correctional institutions, even though they don't mm-hmm. attempt to correct anything. And it seems that the act of resisting, of organizing, of doing something is actually rehabilitative for many of these women. And yet the prisons fear it and try to stamp it out. It seems that this is corrections running up against the so-called correctional institutions that want nothing to do with rehabilitating anybody.
Yes. I mean, it's a euphemism, kind of like the voluntary work program is a euphemism for we're going to make people work so that way we can keep costs of detaining 39,000 immigrants in prisons or in immigrant prisons without having to pay as much money as we would otherwise. Voluntary work program is a euphemism. Correctional institutions are also a euphemism. So ostensibly, you sentence somebody to prison and somehow they gain the skills, the insight, the knowledge, whatever, to quote-unquote correct their behavior, putting the onus on them. But they, even if it was the best-run facility, you know, with tons of programming in which people can get their GED and their, you know, this, that, and the other, and they learn a skill and everything else, they still come back out into a society in which they face the same racial profiling. They face the same, you know, like they face the same economic lack of economic opportunity. They face the same like crappy housing, the same,
plus criminal profiling.
And they now have a felony record as well. So now it's like you go for a job at like, you know, Pizza Hut and they're like, well, you have a felony record.
Right.
You know, like why should we hire you instead of this other person that doesn't have a felony record? So basically, like, even if correctional institution was not a euphemism and there actually was some sort of corrective program, it doesn't actually solve the larger, broader societal lack of opportunities and inequalities that are going on. But in many prisons and jails, if not all of them, there really are a dearth of programs that actually will help people. I'm not saying that there aren't some programs in which certain segments of the prison population benefit from, but overall, people don't get sent to prison to be corrected and to learn better skills. They're sent to prison to basically remove them from society for X period of time. You are no longer in society. You are not other people's problems anymore. We don't have to address all of these other issues that contributed to who you are and what you've done because we've just removed you. And that's it. You just go far, far away and we don't have to see you for X number of years.
And that's the problem. And there are so many issues that I wish we had time to go into, but we're just about out of time. Victoria Law's book is called Resistance Behind Bars, The Struggles of Incarcerated Women. I highly recommend it. There are lists of organizations and ways you can get involved and help at the back of the book. I think clearly we need to improve prisons and close them and shut them down. Victoria Law, thank you for all the work you're doing and for taking the time to come on Talk Nation Radio.
Thanks for having me.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, more than a quarter of the electorate, some 63 million eligible voters, either have a disability or have a household member with one, according to researchers at Rutgers. Add to that the fact that the poverty rate for working-age people with disabilities is nearly 2.5 times higher than that for people without disabilities. And then set that, as did Robin Powell at Rewire, alongside the exorbitant cost of campaigning for public office. The average winning House candidate spent $1.3 million in 2016. For the Senate, that number's $10.4 million. Now you're getting close to an understanding of why people with disabilities are so severely underrepresented in elected office, which itself goes some way toward explaining why, in 2018, disabled people's full inclusion in all aspects of social life is still largely framed as a matter of accommodation rather than rights. Counterspin talked about disability in the election and in the press with Andrew Pulrang, co-founder with Greg Barrettin and Alice Wong of the Crip the Vote campaign, and a blogger at disabilitythinking.com. That conversation's coming up, but first we'll take a look back at recent press. On June 18th, ProPublica released an audio recording from inside a Border Patrol detention facility. Children separated from parents and family members could be heard crying in the background, while a 6-year-old girl from El Salvador begged for someone to let her call her aunt. The recording was a reminder, were it needed, that immigration policy has deep and lasting effects on actual people. However, as Jordan Holycross reported for Fair.org, as corporate media reported the story, the voices of those impacted most by immigration policy were drowned out by sound bites from Congress members and Trump administration officials. Looking at a week's worth of coverage on 6 major broadcast and cable news networks, Holycross found networks airing the voices of 248 sources, of which only 15, or 6%, were current immigrants, whether children or adults. Another 2% could be identified as past immigrants. Those who work with and for immigrants were also missing from many programs. 13 immigration rights advocates were cited overall, amounting to 5% of sources. Meanwhile, 62% of all sources were from the federal government. 47% were Republican officials, mainly representatives of the Trump White House or Congress members. 21% of sources were Democratic officials, mostly members of Congress. Put it this way, for every immigrant voice included in TV coverage of the child separation crisis, viewers heard from 6 different Republican officials. The few immigrants and civil rights advocates who were cited, Holycross found, often explained that those coming to the U.S. are generally escaping life-threatening violence and instability, a factor that neither White House officials nor Congress members touched on. Small surprise, given that that line of inquiry risks broaching the role of U.S. foreign policy in that violence and instability. There were counterexamples, there usually are, but overall, broadcast and cable news's narrow choice of sources meant a loss of critical context and coverage that tended to reduce the lived experience of immigrants to leverage for U.S. politicians. And finally, journalist and Fair associate Sam Husseini went to the Trump-Putin press conference in Helsinki with press credentials from The Nation and a couple of questions. Specifically, he wanted to ask both leaders why they aren't living up to their commitments under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and why they're blocking the treaty for the prohibition of nuclear weapons. Further, based on the idea that there may be no greater threat than a weapon that is unacknowledged, Husseini hoped to ask Trump if he would acknowledge the existence of Israel's nuclear weapons. It wasn't so quixotic. Reuters had just reported Trump saying his ultimate hope for the summit's outcome was, quote, no more nuclear weapons anywhere in the world, close quote. But as listeners may have heard, Husseini, also an analyst at the Institute for Public Accuracy, didn't get to ask those questions. Before the conference started, Finnish security took him out of the room, saying someone had told them he had a sign. He did have a small piece of paper reading Nuclear Test Ban Treaty that he hoped might draw Trump's or Putin's attention, but he was prepared to be told that this was against the rules and to hand it over. As he took it out, though, security officers leapt on him, knocked his glasses off, and dragged him out of the room, and ultimately to a detention facility where they held him incommunicado till the middle of the night. Finnish police couldn't come up with anything to charge Husseini with, but some media could, implying with quotes around the word journalist that Husseini might not be one, or highlighting that he wasn't hanging out with the rest of the pool. It's true, Husseini is not one to pal around with corporate reporters, and he's often an unwelcome sight to the political figures he confronts at the National Press Club and elsewhere with questions they'd rather avoid. Confusion about whether it still counts as journalism when it's challenging to power is as distressing an assessment of today's elite media as you need. But consider also that after Husseini's removal, the press conference went on to leave intact the two leaders' preferred emphasis on nuclear non-proliferation over actual disarmament. It was just that emphasis, more, Husseini argues, about preserving the nuclear power's monopoly on violence than actually ensuring security, that he had hoped to interrupt. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. July 26th will be the 28th anniversary of the Americans with Disability Act. Disability activist and writer Mary Johnson wrote for FAIR about the historic 1990 signing on the White House lawn, at that point, and maybe still, the largest gathering ever of journalists for a disability story. And while celebration was in order, it was hard not to notice the shallowness of some press coverage. One story noted an empty wheelchair and suggested that the occupant might have gotten up and walked on the waves of emotion. And only a single wire piece pointed out that the White House itself lacked the accessible bathrooms that the ADA mandated. Media do tend to cover the ADA anniversary, but that reporting often takes a boring, we've come a long way, there's a long way to go tone, that implies that full human rights for people with disabilities are something less than urgent, and that present the disability community as sort of waiting and hoping for acknowledgement and inclusion. The disability community has always been more complicated, more diverse, more active, and more engaged than elite media suggest, and elections are chances to see evidence of that. Our next guest is Andrew Polrang. He's co-founder, along with Greg Barrettin and Alice Wong, of the Crip the Vote campaign. He also blogs at disabilitythinking.com. He joins us now by phone from Plattsburgh, New York. Welcome to Counterspin, Andrew Polrang.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Let's start with the ADA. It did shift the terms from accommodation of people with disabilities in the workforce, in public space, to a civil rights kind of framing, you know, that it's not noblesse oblige. This is a legal right to access and to opportunity. And I wouldn't want to underestimate the value of simply declaring that. But I wonder, 28 years on, how would you assess the ADA's actual impact? Do we see the spirit and the letter of the law being lived out, do you think?
It's just not an easy question to answer,
Yeah. And
you really can't get around the fact that it depends on what one was expecting from the law to begin with. So, yes, we expected all new buildings to be fully accessible. We expected buildings that were renovated to always have the renovated portions be accessible. And we expected existing buildings that were kind of old to get gradually more accessible in a steady sort of way. We expected transportation to all be accessible, up to including buses and trains and all that kind of stuff. But I think we really expected a lot better employment situations. And anyway, overall, I think that the results have been mixed. That's being kind of charitable. As you pointed out, disability issues do tend to be put on a back burner. Not that they are not important or that people don't acknowledge in the abstract that they might be important, but they just don't ever seem to get to the top of the list. And that includes the top of the list for businesses that are going to open a new store and that type of thing.
I remember very well doing a story about Clint Eastwood at the time, who had been had a restaurant, I guess, that was inaccessible and had been sued. And his response, I thought, was representative in some ways of a certain kind of attitude, which was, why didn't they just ask me?
Well, that's the premise behind, I think it's H.R. 620, the bill in Congress that would actually amend the Americans with Disabilities Act so that you would have to, in some fashion, directly inform somebody before suing them for violation of the ADA, which to a lot of people, maybe most people, sounds like common sense. And in fact, I would say it's what most people do. Most people do not just out of the air one day visit a place, see it's not accessible, and file a lawsuit.
Right.
That's a really hard thing to do. And it's not lucrative for the most part. It's expensive. So most people do, if they do anything at all, they do go and say, hey, your place is inaccessible, and can we fix that? So Clint Eastwood's problem back then and the problems that are cited now, I think you can find anecdotal cases where maybe, you know, you would have done it differently and maybe a place was sort of blindsided or whatever. But I think that's been blown way out of proportion for a political purpose, which is to basically take anything left of the ADA out of it for businesses, essentially.
Right. I just think when people think about it a little deeper, they might wonder why someone would have to make a complaint or make a lawsuit or any of that in order to simply have access to things that folks expect to have access to. You know, the idea that you should simply accept that you're a second-class citizen, you know, and that your polling place might not be accessible, you know. And, you know, right. I just think it's a framing question in terms of just the way we think of it. And I have to confess, mm-hmm. I am never not surprised. I am never not surprised at the willingness of not just media but many people to sort of think, well, that's terrible, but you know, it's not a rights kind of conversation that we tend to have.
The last few years at the anniversary, we are constantly pointing out, you know, now it's going to be 28 years, and the thing is, we've been hearing essentially the same story in some vague form for 28 years, which is that it's not always explicit, but the implication that, oh, these are a bunch of new requirements and it's going to take time. Well, you know, I would accept even 10 years ago, right? I would even accept that that is in some sense new in the grand historical span of the way people have been building buildings. But 28 years is long enough for people to figure this stuff out. And that includes buildings that in 1990 were already existing. And that includes old downtowns with, you know, two steps up to the old store or soda shop or whatever. What we see most in the way of barriers is not so much, you know, unfortunately, not so much, you know, your strip malls and, you know, big shopping centers, but your downtowns, you know, they have their own problems trying to struggle. But they all had steps in front of them because they were all built in the 1890s. But it's been 28 years. There are solutions to these things. I think with the exception of the people who really did their jobs and code enforcement officials who really did their jobs, which they do not always do, most other people kind of put it on the back burner. They kind of know what the ADA is, but they think, well, there's nothing I can do about it. It's just too expensive to, you know, get a better place or put a ramp in or what have you. And I'm just going to wait until somebody complains.
When we think about how to respond to that, when we think about societal solutions to push people to make changes without an individual, you know, coming up and asking them, well, we think about the electoral process and the political process. Mm-hmm. So let's move on to Crypt the Vote. It's an online campaign. It's a kind of space, really, as I understand it, for a conversation. And it started with you and Alice Wong and Greg Barrettin watching the presidential debates back in 2015 and noting the, as Greg called it, the loud silence around issues mm-hmm. affecting people with disabilities. How has Crypt the Vote grown since then? What is its role now going forward into these new elections?
Well, it's really evolved. We started out just live tweeting the debates because the three of us, Greg, Alice, and myself, were just saying, well, you know, once again, we're not probably not going to hear anything, or will we hear anything that even remotely we could relate to as far as disability? And that developed into saying, well, why just the debates? Why don't we have chats on specific topics where we say, okay, at a certain date and time, we're going to have an hour-long discussion on Twitter. And the way it all ties together is through the hashtag, Crypt the Vote. And that's not just a slogan. It's an actual mechanism to follow the conversation. So we started having scheduled chats. We put out questions beforehand so that people could, you know, see what it was going to be about first and prepare some answers, because people have our time sometimes keeping up with Twitter. We also did a online survey, not scientific, but just of our little community, of what issues do we care about most, what are our priorities, and we kind of disseminated that. And we just continued through the conventions and right up until the election and after.
I thought your findings on that survey in terms of what leapt out for people were interesting. What did you learn there?
The one that sticks out is the top issue or the top initiative that we put on the list that got the most votes by far were to appoint and elect more disabled people into public office. So we were thinking in those terms of, so a new president's coming in, who are you going to appoint to run agencies and help run agencies that actually pertain to our issues, and that we want to see representation, not just at the ballot box, but in office. And to me, that was the biggest surprise, because you know, we put it in there thinking, well, let's see what people think about that. And it got the biggest vote of all.
In other words, people really actually want disabled people representing them and not simply to add their list of concerns to a long list of other things, you know, but to actual representation, you know. And that's not
exactly
to say that they didn't care about other issues, but actual representation.
I think we gave them a list of 15 issues to let them choose 10. Healthcare was a big issue.
Wages, home care, services.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I want to just say disabled people vote. Right? You know, this is not, I think this might be a misconception, but vote in numbers very close to average numbers nationally.
We vote less than we should, in the sense that there are fewer of us voting than are eligible.
Right.
And that's always seems to be the case. But in real numbers, it's very large. So it's a significant voting population. I mean, I remember when I first got started in disability rights back around the ADA's passage, people were already saying that an incident that happened in the early 80s regarding disability policy changed how the first President Bush dealt with disability issues. They wanted to do some regulation change regarding disability services, and the outcry was way bigger than they had imagined. Some people lay that as being one of the founding things, that why would this Republican president sign this act, even though it passed Congress. And one of them was that he, at the very least, had a respect for the, you know, the power of the disability movement. And I think we've always been trying to capitalize on that. But, you know, there's a dozen reasons why it's kind of hard to actually turn numbers into clout.
Well, and that's what Crypt the Vote, one of the reasons that I appreciate it so much is that it brings together a range of things that people might not necessarily tag as disability related, you know, but that absolutely are. And I relate it to journalism because with any marginalized group, it's not just a matter of wanting them to do stories on the particular experiences of people with disabilities, for example, but to also locate disabled people within the stories that they are doing every day. You know, I mean, you can read 10 stories about Social Security and not have one of them elaborate what it means for people with disabilities. It's not just, in other words, in terms of media, it's not just an overlooking of the disabled community, but I think in some cases an actual erasure of disabled people from issues that they ought to be part of.
Exactly. I mean, there's an issue going on right now that I think it's a little early to tell exactly how it's going to play out, but the issue of banning plastic straws is a very, very interesting example. You know, as you may be aware, there's it seems to be the hot issue right now as far as grassroots environmental efforts, because it's a thing you can do locally. You can get your municipality, you can get a company to do it. Starbucks says that they're going to ban plastic straws by 2020 or something like that. But there is a significant portion of disabled folks that need plastic straws to be able to drink. The movement got quite far along before anybody took any real notice of the fact that, you know, hey, some of us really need these things. It's just started to come out. I've seen some news stories about it in regular media that are non-specialized, that are pointing out, hey, this is a little problem here. It's an example of how our issues can be absolutely forgotten.
And that things can be so compartmentalized. And this comes back to Crip the Vote, which is an intersectional kind of conversation. I once had kind of a fight with a disability activist who I got a mailer that said essentially, you know, black people have overcome. When is it our turn? You know, and I thought, you know, what if I'm black and disabled, you know, and this can be such a difficulty, I think, for folks. You know, it's not people with disabilities versus black people versus people who care about the environment. You know, that's where the intersectionality comes in. And Crip the Vote has made a space for, you know, thinking across difference, even within the disabled community.
We really have. And I have to say personally that that's been a growth thing for me because, you know, I do come from a tradition which tended to see disability issues. We had sort of an inferiority complex about it, which is kind of understandable because of what we've just been talking about. But one of the strategies I think has been to not ally with other people and not to let other people's, quote unquote, other people's issues get into our own, because we need to focus on disability, because people won't do that. And I think that's just a wrong strategy, for one thing. In addition to being, you know, immoral, I think it's just a flawed strategy. I think you have to ally with other people, and you have to realize that groups overlap in dozens of ways. And I've been very glad that we've been able to do that to some extent, at least in Crip the Vote.
Yeah, it makes for a strength, I think, going forward.
Mm-hmm.
Well, one of the things that you have written about is a set of issues that people might think are electoral issues, but that they might not think about as disability issues. And I just wonder, you know, what are some of the things, whether you're talking to journalists or just to regular folk, you know, what are some things that you might want to put on the radar in terms of, you know, you might not know that this engages the disability community, but it actually is critical there.
Well, okay, I'll mention, first of all, one of the issues that we were hoping to work on, you know, under slightly different circumstances but haven't given up on it, is the subminimum wage. This is where certain subgroups of disabled folks are able to be paid, or are it's legal to pay them less than minimum wage for their work, which, you know, has been a rehabilitation strategy, I guess you could call it, since the 1930s. We feel it's long overdue to be ended. If you're going to have people with disabilities who maybe you say cannot work in a regular job, if you're going to be doing stuff to have them work in workshops or do special kinds of employment, you know, why not just pay the minimum wage? You know what I'm saying? You're already doing all this other stuff. Just go ahead and pay the minimum wage. It's become such an insult and so degrading and so unnecessary, I think, especially right now when the economy in terms of jobs is relatively good, you know, comparatively, when there are alternatives for people to go to. So we want to do that. Another issue is, you know, Medicaid and healthcare in general, but particularly right now Medicaid, because, you know, last year part of the healthcare debate was proposed massive cuts to Medicaid. And a lot of people with disabilities depend on Medicaid, not just for their health care, as we tend to think of it, but for everyday personal care, just to live and function in their own homes. You know, cuts of the size that they were proposing would just not be sustainable, and we would probably lose a lot of those services. And, you know, what you kind of alluded to before, that people don't really know about them so much, is really one of our constant challenges, because let's take the healthcare debate, you know, Medicare for all is a fairly popular idea on the left. I think a lot of us share the general idea of universal health care along the lines of Medicare for all. See, I'm slipping right there. But for people with disabilities, frankly, we would prefer Medicaid for all, because Medicare doesn't do home care. And frankly, a lot of people you run into, I'm not going to say everybody, but a lot of people aren't really sure what's the difference between Medicaid and Medicare. Mm-hmm. So you say, well, Medicare for all, great. I know that what they're referring to is this general idea, but the details do matter. And that's frankly one of the things about disability issues that's sort of unique, is that details always matter with our issues, whether it's the difference between Medicare and Medicaid or the difference between a half-inch step and no step at all. Those little details that everybody looks at and says, well, does it really matter? Well, it almost always really does matter for us.
We've been speaking with Andrew Polrang. He's co-founder of the Crip the Vote campaign, and he blogs at disabilitythinking.com. Andrew Polrang, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Well, thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. The show's engineered by Erica Rosado. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio Eco Shop.
This is Radio Eco Shop with Alex Smith.
Welcome, I'm Alex with four interviews for you in this packed show. Ranging from the most terrible climate news to the most hopeful, here we go. Is the Great Barrier Reef on death row? That's the question asked and answered years ago at the prestigious Royal Society by John Varon. Except the world knows him better as Charlie. He's also been called the Godfather of Coral because about one in five corals were named by him. He was the chief scientist at the Australian Institute of Marine Science and author of the authoritative three-volume set, Corals of the World. Charlie Varon, a warm welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex.
Where did the nickname Charlie come from?
From when I was 6 years old, my school teacher used to call me Mr. Darwin, until one day I brought something nasty into the classroom to scare all the kids. And she said, Charles Darwin, get that out of here. And the name Charlie stuck. I've been called that all my life. I don't answer to anything else.
So you've just returned from yet another sea voyage. What were you up to?
Back up to the northern Great Barrier Reef, basically to see what's been happening to the corals there since I was up there about a month ago.
And how's it going?
Well, it was a very horrible trip. In fact, it was heartbreaking. I went to Lizard Island, which is up in the north and has a big marine station there. And virtually all the coral that had been bleached now looks healthier because it's all covered with slime, slimy filaments, cyanobacteria. And all the corals that we thought would probably pull through haven't. They've bleached as well. So it was a very horrible trip. Terrible, in fact.
This is something that's hard for us to understand as beginners. Why do coral animals suddenly expel the algae that they depend on?
Well, corals live in a very competitive environment where land and sea and air all interface, and it is very competitive. So they get the algae in their tissues that give the biggest bang for the buck. But that means getting the algae that are as close as possible to the maximum temperature they're exposed to. Well, for the last million years or so, that's been fine. But we're now exceeding the maximum temperature that they've been selected for. So the algae are getting toxic. They release too much oxygen, and that oxygen actually kills the coral cells, as it will any animal if you get too much. And so the coral expels the algae, forgetting that they absolutely depend on the algae for their food supply, and they die. And so what happens first, you see the algae being expelled, and the coral turns white because the color comes from the algae. And then the little polyps get smaller and smaller, they shrink, and within about a month or so, they die. So that's happening right across the Indo-Pacific now. It's the worst year we've ever had.
Can they come back once they bleach?
No, the coral dies. If there's their colony, so if some of the polyps still hang on, they can regrow at least part of the colony, but mostly the whole colony dies, and it's only new seeding of new larvae can the reef regenerate. But coral bleaching typically doesn't wipe out all the corals on a reef. But this time, that is the normal story. At least they're wiping out a big part of most of the reefs of the Northern Great Barrier Reef. It's pretty horrible to see, I can tell you.
It's touching. So do we have a direct and proven link between climate change and this disaster you're telling us about now for coral?
Well, you can never specifically point to cause and effect, but we know it is definitely linked to carbon dioxide levels. There's no conceivable doubt of that. And if you look at the plot of graphs of plot carbon dioxide levels over time, you see then they're normally between 280, 320 parts per million. We've now hit 400 parts per million, and the spike is just climbing vertically on almost any scale. So it's blindingly obviously due to humans putting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. There is no other explanation.
So is there some upper limit in carbon emissions where we can just say we won't have any coral?
Yeah, we're at that now.
Oh.
What happens is that the oceans, they respond slowly. It's like putting a kettle on the stove. The kettle's cold when you put it on and takes a while to warm up. So if you think of the oceans as being a very big kettle, we've put this blanket of carbon dioxide, which is warming the oceans. We've put it there. And it'll take about another 20 years for the ocean temperature to equilibrate to the blanket of warming we've got now. And so if we stopped adding carbon dioxide to the atmosphere, kept it around what it is now, it would take about 20 years for the oceans to equilibrate with that. So the outlook is horrific.
And I've heard snippets about coral dying in the Indian Ocean as well. Is this a worldwide event where the coral is under threat?
Yes, it's right across the Indian Ocean, and it's been right across the Pacific. We don't know the extent of it in great detail because there's only a fairly narrow window of time that you can actually see the bleaching. If you flew over the Northern Great Barrier Reef now, you wouldn't see much bleaching at all because filamentous algae grow on the dead coral, and they take over in a matter of weeks. So as most of the coral reefs of the Indo-Pacific are fairly remote from humans, we don't really ever capture a good idea of how extensive bleaching's been. But NOAA's temperature forecast was horrific, and they've been correct. So we expected a lot of damage, but fortunately the worst was averted because the local weather in this part of the world did reverse somewhat. We had a big cyclone off Fiji, and so a normal monsoon set in before the ENSO cycle could do its worst, the natural cycle of warmth that is an atmospheric thing. So the central and southern Great Barrier Reef mostly have not had severe bleaching. All the corals would have been sick, but bleaching occurs right down through the range of corals right around Australia and out into the Indian Ocean. And as you probably know, the coral in the Hawaiian chain has been really badly damaged, and there's been endless reports of bleaching elsewhere in the Pacific. So it's a pretty it's been a very bad year.
Are there deep cold water coral as well?
There's reef corals that do live in quite cold water. In this case, down as far as Sydney, there's a few species and so on. That's bleaching too. So corals do respond to what's normal in their local environment. But there's a whole other group of corals that don't resemble reef corals much, that live in very deep water, and they don't have algae in their tissues, so they don't bleach. But even reef corals are quite happy tolerating the temperature we have. But when you combine that with sunlight, that's the combination that causes them to die.
So as you've told us, coral has been around for perhaps 500 million years. It's come through several mass extinction events. It's still here. Why are you concerned this time around, Charlie Varon?
Well, the coral of the Paleozoic was entirely wiped out by the end of the Paleozoic, the great mass extinction then, and nothing survived. And the coral we have now is another group of organisms, the soft-bodied organisms, evolved. So that happens when corals can be completely wiped out. But that's never happened any other time. We've had over 30 occasions in the geological record where reefs have been wiped out as far as the geological record shows, and they haven't come back for a long period of time, you know, hundreds of thousands of years perhaps. But of the mass extinctions, all but one of those are fairly obviously associated with ocean acidification. It's because it's really hard to find anything that could affect the oceans as much as that worldwide. So we're looking at two things. We're looking at the bleaching, which will have affected corals everywhere in geological time, and also ocean acidification. Now, corals can't evolve mechanisms to cope with acidification much, but they can evolve a capacity to have different algae in their tissues, which is tolerant of temperature. But this is evolutionary time. We're talking about hundreds of thousands of years. We're not giving corals the time to adapt to what's been thrown at them now. And as you no doubt know, the rate of increase in carbon dioxide is not abating at all. It's just keeping on, keeping on. So it's a very doom and gloom outlook. It's very serious.
Well, from the human perspective, I mean, setting aside the beauty and the right of coral to exist in its own right, as an Australian, what does it mean if the Great Barrier Reef suffers a major decline? What are the impacts for fisheries or for the human economy?
Well, for the Great Barrier Reef, they're massive. The Great Barrier Reef is worth about $7 billion a year to Australia and employs 70-odd thousand people. So there's that aspect of it. But the real harm is not a human one. Corals are home for about a third of all marine species somewhere in the life cycle. And that includes a heck of a lot of fish. So if you take out corals, you also will take out a big swag of the diversity of the oceans. And that's what we have seen in the fossil record. First of all, coral reefs go, and then the diversity of the ocean plummets, and the oceans are really the lungs of the earth. Atmospheric conditions are moderated by the oceans all the time. And when you take life out of the oceans on that scale, the oceans cease to have the same function a healthy planet has. And that's when that gets really severe, that's when a mass extinction kicks in, and that takes out terrestrial life as well.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with one of the world's great coral experts, John or Charlie Varon. Unfortunately, we are talking about coral on death row as the world heats up. Charlie, I've got to ask you, what got you going on coral in the first place?
I was doing my PhD on neurosecretions, of all things. I've never been to a lecture in marine biology in my life. And I decided to take up diving for fun. And we found lots of corals off the coast of New South Wales, not far north of Sydney. And no coral had ever been recorded there, but there's some islands. And we went out there for fun diving. And it was a fabulous spot covered with corals. And I decided that we would go ahead and do our best to make this into a marine park. In fact, only last week I was down there celebrating the 25th anniversary of the marine park. It wasn't my doing. Our study was long lost and forgotten, but then it was picked up by another group, and that's the start of the marine park there. But my diving goes back to those days when I was doing fun dives, but I soon turned that into firstly, my hobby, and then, as I keep on doing, turning my hobby into my job. And so I became the first scientist to be employed by the Australian Institute of Marine Science. And I have been on 66 expeditions, 6,000 hours of diving all over the world, redoing the taxonomy of corals, the distribution, and then into their evolution and all sorts of other things. But it started as a hobby, and certainly became one of my foremost loves in life. It's very easy to get very closely attached to coral reefs. They're, and it never wears off. I get thrilled just as much today as I ever did diving on a really beautiful coral reef, and I'm afraid it's been a good while since I've had that pleasure. They're all going backwards.
I can hardly imagine the pain you must be feeling to see them suffering and threatened with extinction.
Well, it's horrible. I mean, it's just terrible. If you're a music lover and you see one orchestra after another collapse for whatever reason, and you get less and less music, and that music you do get is really second-rate stuff, and you've seen the very best there is, your life becomes almost intolerably diminished. And I find myself in that predicament. It's very hard to cope with. Yep.
I think we're all entering that predicament as we see the climate we've come to know disappear and some great troubles coming. So look, Charlie, what do you recommend to listeners who want an introduction to coral and how it works? Is there a film, a website, or a book we should all get in touch with?
Well, there are many and there are none. I wrote a book called A Reef in Time, The Great Barrier Reef from Beginning to End. It's published by Harvard. It was in 2008, and that gives the science behind what we've just been talking about. Yeah, that book was the book that precipitated an emergency meeting of the Royal Society in London, which was chaired by David Attenborough, who's highly regarded in this corner of the world. Books about the Great Barrier Reef, I think there's about 700, but of coral reefs, a very large number. Mostly the books that I've written concentrate on coral, that being my speciality. But from there, there's speciality books about fish and whales and a lot of other marine life, and also a lot of fabulous books depicting the beauty of coral reefs. So it is something that everybody really needs to see, because it really is the showcase of nature on this planet.
It's been designated a World Heritage Site by the United Nations, but I wonder how much duty falls to Australia to protect it, and how is Australia doing when it comes to trying to save this reef?
Well, Australia is doing the worst thing it possibly can, and that is giving okay for massive amounts of coal mining. It only just last month gave it the go-ahead for a mine that will put 3.5 billion tonnes of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. Australia it's got an abominable track record. It's politicising this by spending money on the Great Barrier Reef on things that actually don't need doing. But basically, when you spend a whole lot of money looking after the water quality or trying to control a starfish that eat coral, that is money wasted if you're going to have a reef that's going to die anyhow. So every country, not just Australia, but every country has got to do its absolute utmost to get on to renewable energy and get unhooked from fossil fuels. Unfortunately, that's not a vote winner in Australia. Well, it might be. We just hope it will become that. But our political parties, both of them, have okayed this coal mining, although one party, the left-wing party, is doing some things towards climate change mitigation. We've had this meeting in Paris, as you'll know, that was very successful because it got a whole lot of countries to actually sign on to the existence of climate change, which is so late in coming, it's heartbreaking, but this could have happened 25 years ago. Science was there 25 years ago. Anyhow, a lot of countries, most countries in the world have signed on to that, but I'm afraid the premise is a false one. Their aim is to keep the world's increase in temperature below 2 degrees, and that's not possible. So we are in for a horrific time, and the only way of getting through this is to have countries committed doing big things towards stopping climate change.
And so most of my listeners do feel this threat to coral right in their hearts, I think. What can we do?
The main thing you can do is vote for politicians who are going to control, who say they're going to control fossil fuel mining and are going to support getting on to green energy. That's the strongest thing. But then there's the individual's lifestyle. And as you know, we're getting very fuel-efficient cars. And that makes a hell of a difference. And, of course, we've got appliances in most houses, which are now becoming very efficient. And we've got to give technology the space, the time to develop and kick in. Unfortunately, if you go mining coal, that will always undercut the cost of the technology. And so the longer countries keep mining coal, and there's an awful lot of it yet to come, that will put the brakes on alternative technology for developing renewable resources. So Australia's doing really badly at that, I'm afraid.
So, Charlie, maybe we shouldn't leave this as a funeral. Would you tell us one or two stories about the strangeness of coral or the wonders that you've found?
Yes, I hate leaving this as a funeral. I hate being the doom and gloom merchant because most of my life, coral reefs have been fabulous places and I would never have even dreamt that this would ever change in this way. But to dive down on a healthy coral reef is really a fabulous experience. And I think one of the greatest times I've had in my life is diving at night and turning the torch off and just enjoying the moonlight. And the whole reef is just crawling with life. See life absolutely everywhere. And you can turn the torch on and it all changes. Colour suddenly leaps at you. There's nothing remotely like this. I think probably the nearest thing would be some spectacular rainforest garden or something like that. But coral reefs also have the intangible thrill of being, well, dangerous. You never know about some of the life that swims past you. But the overwhelming thrill of diving on beautiful reefs is just the diversity and just the amount, the quantity of living things that the reef supports. There's nothing like it anywhere on this planet, not even a rainforest. That is the great thrill of diving on a beautiful coral reef.
To me, it's like visiting the heartbeat of nature.
It definitely is that. There's nothing in the oceans that have anything like the diversity of coral reefs, not 1% of it. So for the oceans, that's it, coral reefs or somewhere else that's nothing remotely comparable. But for the whole world, I guess going into an Amazon-type rainforest and seeing the diversity of life there and the excitement and the thrills and that, all that, that's the next best thing. I think the greatest thrill you can ever have I love immersing myself in nature. I always have since I was a child, whether it be a forest or a reef. And to immerse yourself in a reef, just to take the time to just look around and really feel it, is one of the great privileges of living on this planet, I'll put it that way. It certainly is for me, and it is for an awful lot of people. Everyone should go see a coral reef because it will stay in their memory forever until they die. It is one of the most thrilling things, I think, you can do on Earth today as far as looking at nature is concerned. That's how I can put it, but there's nothing like it.
Well, John Viren, is better known as Charlie, has won numerous awards. His book, A Reef in Time, The Great Barrier Reef, From Beginning to End, is still the classic to read, in my opinion. And you can check my show blog at ecoshock.info for a link to that video of Charlie presenting to the Royal Society, introduced by David Attenborough. Charlie, thank you so much for sharing your time and for being such a good friend to Coral during your lifetime.
Thanks, Alex, and what a nice interview that was. Appreciate it.
Radio EcoShock.
Top scientists warn humans must start removing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere or we could encounter a climate catastrophe. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change assumes we will use so-called carbon capture and storage. But where is the technology to do it? Nothing reliable has appeared until now. A project in Iceland has discovered a way to convert carbon dioxide into stone in less than 2 years. That's fantastic news. It's a game changer, but it has limitations. Let's discover what this new tech called CarbFix is all about. Our guest is a co-author of a new paper published in the journal Science on June 10, 2016. The title is Rapid Carbon Mineralization for Permanent Disposal of Anthropogenic Carbon Dioxide Emissions. Dr. Martin Stute was educated at Heidelberg University. He is now professor of environmental science at Barnard College, Columbia University in New York, and a hydrologist at Columbia University's Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory. Martin Stute, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
It's exciting news. We're not talking about a theory or a model, but a carbon storage process that has already worked. Have you held a piece of this new carbon stone in your hand? What is it like?
Yes, I have. Actually, the first time we saw it was in a monitoring well. So we are injecting the CO2 with water at one place, and it flows through the subsurface. Then the reactions happen. And then we have a monitoring well, another hole in the ground where we have pumps, and we pump up water to the surface and monitor the composition of this water to find out what's happening. And what happened is that the pump failed. So that was the first time we saw it. We pulled out the pump, and the inside of the pump and on the outside of the pump and on the pipes, there was a white material that looks like if you pour sugar on a surface, so small crystals. And then, of course, we analyzed these crystals right away, and we noticed that these crystals are carbonate minerals, you know, same material that seashells are made of. And then we knew that these minerals are forming in the system, so we are converting CO2 into minerals.
And where is this all taking place?
So this is taking place maybe 30 kilometers east of Reykjavik, the capital of Iceland, and it's very close to a geothermal power plant. And we are using gases that are released currently from this power plant into the air, and we pipe that to a site a few kilometers away, and then we inject it close by into a basalt formation. Now, you would think that maybe geothermal power plants should not emit anything. You know, they are very green, renewable energy, and so on. But the reason why they emit CO2 is that the very hot water that they convert into steam that then drives the turbine also contains CO2 from very deep in the earth. This is a volcanic area, and there is CO2, and the CO2 is in the water, in the steam, and currently gets released into the atmosphere. So the Icelanders wanted to not emit the CO2 to help prevent climate change, and they decided to invest into a technology to get rid of it.
And could you describe for us sort of a brief step-by-step of capturing and storing carbon dioxide at this plant?
So the capture process is actually fairly easy in this situation because the gases come out of the turbine and we can actually use the gases almost as they are. There's a little bit of treatment of the gas, so there's some hydrogen in there that we reduce the concentration of in a very fast process in the power plant. And then the remaining gases, which is mostly CO2 and hydrogen sulfide in this particular case, this rotten-smelling, rotten egg smell. So these two gases then go through a pipeline, and they go to a well a few kilometers away. They are pumped down through a pipeline, through a tube, into the well. And then at the same time, we are pumping water through another pipe also into the well. And then at depth, like in an aquarium, we have a sparger or, bubble stone that you would buy for an aquarium, Of course, it's much bigger in this case. The CO2 bubbles out of one pipe and then mixes with the water that we pumped at the same time. So by the time that this mixture enters the formation, you know, the basalt formation, the CO2 is completely dissolved in the water. There are no bubbles left, which prevents any CO2 from leaking upward, which can be a problem at conventional CO2 sequestration or CO2 storage sites, because as long as CO2 is in gas phase, it can move upwards, of course, like bubbles would in a glass of seltzer water. The chances that they would reach the surface at these other sites are extremely small, but it's not zero. So in our case, we dissolve the CO2 right away in the water, and then there's no incentive for the CO2 to move upwards anymore. And then, of course, in the second step, the CO2 reacts with the basaltic rock and forms these carbonates that then stay behind as initially small crystals, which will grow over time in the rock.
That's pretty clear. Now, the key to it is this rock called basalt. What is that?
So it's a volcanic rock. You know, consider it, it's basically lava flows in Iceland. You know, there are lots of volcanoes in Iceland. There were recent eruptions, as you know. Over the years, thousands of years, there were many eruptions. So there are lots of layers of this lava. And the formation of this kind of rock is called basalt. And it is very fresh, and it has this property that it reacts with CO2 also under natural conditions. So it forms carbonates. But we all thought that this would be a very slow process, and perhaps we couldn't use this to actually engineer it to deposit CO2. But this experiment showed that actually this can work on a very short time scale, very fast, much faster than we all anticipated.
And Martin, as we learned from your paper in Science, another required component is lots of water. Previously, water wasn't considered important in carbon capture and storage. How much water is required, and could seawater be used?
I think we don't really know the answer yet. No field experiment has been done, but it's likely it will work. There are some hints that it will work. But of course, one has to really try it, as we did in Iceland in the real world, and perhaps inject CO2 dissolved in seawater into a basalt, which could be an ocean floor basalt. I mean, that's the ocean floors is the place on the Earth where the basalt is very common. 90% of the ocean floor or more is basalt. So if we could figure out how to do this on the ocean floor, that would really be fantastic, you know, because we had an unlimited reservoir of basalt. If we just would have to get the CO2 to the oceans, and that would be a problem, potentially, you know, if it's far away. But there are many coastal areas that have basalt just offshore, and there are many power plants near the coastlines because power plants want to be where people are, and people like to be near coastlines. But I think it's a little bit too early to tell if this works or not, because it has to be really tried in a pilot experiment similar to the one in Iceland.
Yeah, when I was looking into this, I noticed previous research into storing carbon dioxide under the sea in basalt. For example, there's a 2008 paper, Carbon Dioxide Sequestration in Deep Sea Basalt by Goldberg et al.
Right.
But now you've added some new twists to this, especially the injection of water. And so this is a little bit different from what they had envisioned, is it?
I mean, what they are envisioning is it's all theory, right, at this point in time. So it's an idea that would have to be tested. I think they were considering not only CO2 dissolved in water injections, but they were thinking also of injection of CO2, pure CO2. But because there's water in these formations anyway, the reactions might work in a similar way. I guess we need to find out. We don't know for sure.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. And some other countries who could use it. Could America do it?
Yeah, I mean, there are the biggest basalt occurrence in the United States is the Columbia River basalt in Washington State. So that would be a potential location. There are basalts offshore of New York City, actually, off the west coast of the United States. And then within the country, there are several spots as well. So about 10% of the continental rocks are basalts.
And how about India, for example?
India is another big basalt occurrence. So that has also been proposed in previous papers to study that place.
And you moved the CO2 in a pipeline. Could we picture some way of transporting the CO2 from power plants that aren't near basalt to remote locations and then store it the way CarbFix is doing?
Yeah, we could envision that. It just will add significantly to the cost of the technology.
And can bacteria get into this carbon-loaded rock and destabilize it?
There's no evidence for that yet. So there are groups that are studying this. So certainly the role of life in this process is probably underappreciated and has not been studied as much because it's very complicated. There are so many different kinds of microbes that live down there. But there is a group associated with the CarbFix program that does just that. And they are studying the role of microbes in these systems. So they may be important. We don't know for sure yet.
And the other big news, which you've mentioned in this CarbFix story, is how quickly that CO2 morphed into a stable stone. Could you tell us a little bit more about that, what the previous expectations were and what happened?
Yeah, so the previous expectations were that this would take a very long period of time, hundreds of years, maybe longer than that. Then people started to do laboratory experiments, and they actually found out that it's significantly faster than that. And then there was a modeling study a few years ago that took the composition of this local basalt and, you know, a lot of information that had been gathered in laboratory experiments for many years, and they predicted that it would take about 10 years. But the scientific community just didn't believe that paper. It was actually a little difficult to publish because they just didn't believe that this could happen that fast. And then it actually happened in 2 years. So much faster even than that. Why that is, we speculate in the paper. We have some ideas why it could be. We may underestimate, for example, the surface area of the rocks. Part of that might have been a dissolution of existing carbonates through our injections that then were deposited someplace else. So there are several theories why what happened, but we actually have a difficult time at the moment to differentiate between them. So we need further studies to figure this out.
And of course, the worry, Martin, with any good news about carbon capture and storage is that the public will run away with it. People may think it's okay to pollute now because scientists have a permanent solution. Do you worry about that?
I do, yes. And I want to be clear and say this is not a silver bullet. I think we have to invest in lots of different approaches, you know, switching to renewable energy. We need to be more efficient. We need to look at other carbon sequestration techniques, and this could play a major role in this whole discussion, but it's not a silver bullet. It's not solving our problems. You know, it's rather, I think we have to push these other technologies as fast as we can, but we feel like we cannot really displace fossil fuel energy sources very rapidly. We should do it as fast as we can, but it's not going to happen overnight. And while in this transition period, this technology could be very relevant. And also, I wanted to mention one other thing. You know, we may even underestimate the damaging effects of climate change. Who knows? You know, people usually claim that it doesn't exist and we are overestimating it. But the other thing could happen too. Maybe we underestimate it. And maybe we have to, at some point in the future, remove CO2 from the atmosphere just to reduce the levels. So capture CO2 from the air. And then this technology could be very relevant. You know, if it works in the oceans, we could actually capture CO2 out of the atmosphere on old drilling platforms maybe and inject the CO2 into nearby basalt formations. And then we could lower the CO2 levels. I don't know if we will have to get there, but if we do, you know, we better be ready to do this and make sure it works.
Yes, because scientists like James Hansen say we need to go back down to at least 350 parts per million of CO2 in order to maintain any sort of ice at the poles, and we need that in order to have our climate system, and on we go. Look, as an aside, can you tell us about your other research into ways to figure out the ancient past by analyzing current groundwater?
Oh, you're aware of that. So groundwater moves very slowly in the subsurface. So if you go a few hundred meters below ground and you are in an area, what we call a sedimentary basin, basically a bathtub filled with sediments, then since groundwater moves very slowly, you know, maybe a meter per year or something like that, if you know where your groundwater enters the subsurface and you have wells downstream, you can collect samples from these wells and you can actually determine how old that water is that you sample in a well. And, you know, surprisingly, you find water that can be 10,000 years old, 20,000 years old or older. And that means a lot of this groundwater that we are drinking today is actually from 20,000 years ago. So it entered the ground that long time ago. And I took advantage in my earlier research on figuring out what we can learn about the past from these old groundwaters. So if I have a water sample from a well that's 20,000 years old, that water sample will record certain things that happened at the time when it was near the surface. For example, how cold or warm it was at the time, how much rain was falling at the time, et cetera, et cetera. There's a whole bunch of parameters one can look at. And the method that gave me the most interesting results is the dissolved gas content of this water, which actually allowed me to say how cold or warm it was at the time of recharge when this water entered the ground. And I was able to say, you know, 20,000 years ago, this place in Brazil, for example, the temperature was 5 degrees C lower than it is today. So it allows me to measure the temperature in the past.
Wow. I think that's exciting stuff. And, you know, just as I could say that the water that I'm drinking is probably 20,000 years old. It's fossil water. And that means it's before the atomic residues from atomic testing and before chemicals that are polluting other people's water. So I'm happy to have it.
Yeah, it's not unusual that you drink water that is very, very old. The closest place from New York City is Atlantic City, New Jersey, right, where all the casinos are. And that water that is coming out of a fountain in a casino in Atlantic City is 20,000 years old.
Amazing. So with this CarbFix project, are you excited to be involved with something that might actually help us prevent a climate disaster even a little?
How can I say no? Of course. Yeah, I'm very excited about this. Yeah. So it's a big step forward. And in the life of a scientist, this doesn't happen very often that you feel like you have been part of a discovery that could make a big difference.
We've been talking with Dr. Martin Stutta from Columbia University. He co-authored the paper, Rapid Carbon Mineralization for Permanent Disposal of Anthropogenic Carbon Dioxide Emissions. You can find links to all this in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Martin, thank you for telling us a little good news for a change.
Oh, you're welcome. It was a pleasure.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
At the 2015 World Leaders Summit in Paris, there was a lot of talk about saving the climate. But really, fossil fuel burning is only increasing. What if we do it? What if we burn the currently known reserves of reasonably accessible coal, oil, and gas? What happens to the world's climate? And could humans survive there? We know a little bit more about that thanks to a scientific letter published May 23, 2016. It's in the journal Nature Climate Change. The title is The Climate Response to 5 Trillion Tons of Carbon. We've reached the lead author, Kasia Tokarska. She's from the School of Earth and Ocean Sciences at the University of Victoria in Canada. Kasia, thank you so much for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Oh, well, thank you very much for your call.
Well, please tell us why you and your co-authors decided to do this research.
We think it is relevant to know what would happen if we do not take any actions to mitigate climate change. For example, if we do not ever implement the Paris Agreement or other similar agreements. Our study shows a profound climate change in the absence of further mitigation actions.
Well, we need to get to a few basics, I think. First, it's hard to imagine a trillion tons of carbon. What is the scientific sort of language for that, and how much have we burned so far?
So since the year 1870, we have emitted about 540 gigatons of carbon, which is equivalent to a mass of 5 million Titanic ships. And if we continue a business-as-usual scenario and freely combust Earth's remaining fossil fuel resources, we might end up with a total amount of emitted 5 trillion tons of carbon, and that would be equivalent to a mass of 95 million Titanic ships. So that's a lot of carbon.
So is a gigaton a million tons?
So 1 gigaton is 1,000 tons of carbon, and 1 ton of carbon is 1,000 kilograms of carbon, if we go with the SI unit.
Okay. Now, how did your team decide about the amounts of fossil fuels we might consume?
We are just using the lower estimate of what could be the amount of fossil fuel consumed. However, with the recent technology, we don't consider those other sources such as the shale gas or other things that right now we're not using as fossil fuels, but they could be used maybe with the technology ongoing. So we're looking at the best case of the worst case scenario.
And there is a surprise in this new paper. Some previous science suggested that as we overload the atmosphere with carbon dioxide, the impact of even more, say another trillion tons, becomes less than the earlier pollution. What was the logic behind that?
Previous studies have mostly explored using simpler climate models, and those simpler climate models might not have a good representation of the some processes in the Earth system, especially the ocean heat uptake and the ocean carbon uptake. So as we know, the ocean takes up carbon and heat. So whatever we emit right now, the temperature that the global mean temperature is, whatever the global mean temperature is actually being diminished by the heat that is being taken up by the ocean. And those simpler models show that the ocean continues to take up heat even at those higher levels of carbon emitted. However, in the more complex models that we use, the ocean heat uptake actually diminishes at those higher levels of carbon emitted, which means the ocean gets saturated maybe with heat, and then it doesn't take up as much heat as it does currently. So as a result, we feel the higher net warming effect compared to those simpler models.
And how fast did your team consider we would burn that 5 million tons, or does the pace of emissions matter to the outcome?
We considered a business-as-usual scenario where we continue to emit at a rate similar to the current rate, and then 5 trillion tons of carbon emitted happens to be around year 2200, depending on the model, but in the 2200s decade.
Okay, so let's be specific. Kasia Takarska, if we burn it all, what happens to the global mean temperature?
Well, if we continue to burn Earth's remaining fossil fuel resources, the Earth will encounter a profound climate change, with the global mean warming ranging between 6.4 and 9.5 degrees Celsius. And that's a global mean warming. The regional warming can be even more profound. Most of the warming would be felt by the northern high latitudes and the Arctic, and the Arctic could warm even between 14.7 and 19.5 degrees Celsius.
That's a whole different world.
It will be very profound climate change. We focus on the physical climate change response, so we didn't really study the impacts. However, based on the other studies available right now from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change or the IPCC Fifth Assessment Report, we can say that probably some of the regions would not be habitable at this time, and there probably will not be any Arctic sea ice left in the summer.
A few years ago, when talking with scientists, they would tell me that the tropics would not warm all that much. I've heard scientists say that. Do you agree?
Well, most of the warming is felt by the northern high latitudes due to all those different processes such as the ice albedo feedback and polar amplification. The tropics are also warming as well, but not as much as the northern high latitudes.
Given the research that you've done, do you personally think there's any hope of containing global warming below the former 2 degrees safe level?
Well, I hope our research is only an what-if study, what would happen if we burn our remaining fossil fuel resources, but hopefully we'll not go all the way there. And some people might say, well, year 2200, that's a long time away from now. But I think our study really shows that now is the time to act if we don't want to encounter this profound climate change later on.
Yes, my grandchild's children could be alive in 2200.
Exactly. And on a personal level, I motivate my research by a quote from Pope Francis saying, what kind of world do we want to leave for those who come after us, for the children who are now growing up? So knowing how the world could look like at 5 trillion tons of carbon emitted, we might not want to go all the way there. And right now, we still have some time to act before it is too late.
Kasia, your letter in Nature Climate Change also talks about important changes to precipitation if we burn all the fossil fuels. Can you tell us about that?
So the precipitation changes are very interesting as well because they are extreme in both ends. Some regions could experience even 4 times as high precipitation as they have right now, while other regions could experience decline in precipitation twice as little or even 3 times as little.
You're describing an incredible and dangerous world, and I presume that a global mean temperature rise between 6 and 9 degrees centigrade, with more humidity in some places, means some parts of the world could become uninhabitable. Any guesses where?
Unfortunately, yeah, we study only physical climate change, so we didn't look at the impact. So I'm not able to provide the answer for this one.
But you did reference a paper in your references by Sherwood and Huberb on the limits of human survival in a hot, wet world.
Right, yeah. And they look at global mean warming up to 9 degrees, around 9 degrees Celsius, and they say some regions would not be habitable. But right now, I don't remember which one.
Okay. I think from my reading, the Middle East starts out as one of the real danger zones, Abu Dhabi, places like that. Well, now, you talked about climate models, and this paper mentions four different climate models. Were these the variety known as CMIP5, that's the Coupled Model Intercomparison Project Phase 5 models?
So we're using comprehensive climate models. So in climate models, each component of the climate system, such as the atmosphere, ocean, land, ice sheets, can be thought of as being represented as a piece of a puzzle. And those pieces of puzzle are interconnected between each other and interact between each other. And then we look at different scenarios. So, for example, at the very high carbon emission scenario, it's like adding additional pieces of carbon puzzle and then seeing how those interactions and the final results change in response to that scenario. And because we're using comprehensive climate models from the CMIP5 project, those models have quite good representation of those different processes that happen between those different components of the climate system.
Again, following up on the references in your paper, I found the one by Friedlingstein et al. And it was talking about the difficulties of using climate models. But in that paper, they talked about in this century, carbon emissions at about 795 to 1145 parts per million. That's double to triple what we have today. How does that fit with your research?
So parts per million, that refers to the atmospheric CO2 concentration. So in our research, we look up to around 1,200 parts per million, I think, CO2 concentration. So it's even higher levels of carbon in the atmosphere.
And that same paper also talked about the difficulties of the carbon cycle feedbacks on land. And I know that one of your co-authors, Andrew Weaver, wrote a paper in 2012 about permafrost melt. In this new work, did you account for feedbacks from a rapidly changing Arctic?
I think permafrost feedbacks are actually not included in those models yet. There are lots of recent studies trying to include the permafrost feedbacks, but the models we used didn't have it yet. And yes, the land carbon cycle especially is very difficult to be represented by the models. However, if we look at the response of the both ocean and land carbon uptake, ocean takes up most of the carbon. So the net effect of the land carbon cycle is much smaller than the ocean one. And especially at those higher levels of carbon emitted, ocean is the dominant carbon sink and heat sink. So in a way, this uncertainty doesn't really affect our results that much.
You know, I think you represent a couple of new trends I'm seeing develop in climate-related science. For one thing, we're seeing more coming from undergrads like yourself. Previously, years ago in publications, the most senior author was always listed as the lead author, even if the undergrad inspired and did most of the work. Do you think this change reflects the urgency of the climate situation? You're not a professor or a doctor as yet, are you?
No. I'm a PhD student. And I think right now the trend is that PhD students are expected to publish free papers in order to graduate. So what the study is definitely a collaboration effort with senior scientists, such as my second and third authors are my co-supervisors. And because I did most of the data analysis, I ended up being the first author.
But you probably don't know that years ago it didn't used to be that way. Even if you inspired it and did all the work, the senior scientist's name went on the paper as the lead author, and now that's changing. We're letting undergrads get published when they do good work.
Well, I think that's a good change.
I think so, too. And the other thing is, I'm talking to more and more women climate scientists, and I think that's great. And maybe I have a misconception, but I think that women have been generally known to think more about future generations, so this could really help us.
Oh, I think so, too. I definitely just like, in general, the trend of seeing more women in sciences. I did my undergraduate degree in physics, and definitely it would be nice to have more, seeing more women students during that time. So, yeah, so definitely I think it would be good to have an equal ratio.
Getting back to your new paper, The Climate Response to 5 Trillion Tons of Carbon, what has been the response?
We got a lot of media coverage, actually, on this paper, which is really great. We got articles in The Guardian, National Geographic website, and I was really happy to see that people are very interested in our study. And it's great because knowing what would happen if we end up burning Earth's fossil fuel resources, we might actually maybe raise more awareness, and those people who read those articles might be able to change their own behaviors. And then if everybody just contributes a little bit, we might be able to have a change on a global scale.
And Cassia, once you know the worst place we can go, and that's what this paper is sort of about, what do you tell your friends about the future?
Well, I would say now is the time to act.
Yeah, this is almost kind of activist science in a way.
I think we're living in a crucial time right now because what the Paris Agreement is about, limiting the global mean warming at 1.5 degrees above the pre-industrial level. However, currently we're nearly around the 1 degree above it. So we have very little room to even reach the goal of the Paris Agreement. So it is a very crucial time we're right now in. And if we don't take any prompt actions to limit emissions, we'll just keep going down this road. And our study shows the worst case scenario in the case.
And as we finish up, what new scientific research interests you the most?
Well, in my previous research during my master's, I actually looked at the opposite case. Is it possible to undo climate change? So, for example, if we emit carbon to the atmosphere, but then we use net negative emission technologies to remove this carbon dioxide from the atmosphere that we emitted, can we undo climate change? And I found it very interesting to see that global mean temperature actually is somewhat easy to reverse. However, other components of the climate system, such as sea level, continue to rise despite those negative emission effects. I find it very interesting to see those different scenarios and what would happen if we do this or that. And as much as negative emission technologies might be necessary to actually reach those global temperature climate goals, we should not put fully our faith in it because they cannot substitute our efforts just to stop emitting right now.
What you said is incredibly important, I think. We've been talking with another bright mind developing in the climate community. Cassia Tokarska is from the School of Earth and Ocean Sciences at the University of Victoria in Canada. She's the lead author of the science letter, The Climate Response to 5 Trillion Tons of Carbon, as published in the journal Nature Climate Change. You can find links to this science in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for your call.
Here's a short interview from the Australian radio maker Phil Stubbs as he talks with visiting scholar Stefan Ramsdorf of the Potsdam Institute.
So, Stefan, is the long, hot summer that we've been experiencing connected to climate change?
Yes, it is. It's part of a general warming trend, which has increased the number of heat records around the world quite dramatically. We have looked at this at our institute, and we now get 5 times more monthly heat records around the world than you would in an unchanging climate. And, of course, in Sydney, we have just experienced a record-breaking long spell of temperatures above 26 degrees that's been going on for more than 5 weeks now and has doubled the previous record long spell of such warm temperatures. And nationwide in Australia, a new record for March temperatures was set that was a full degree centigrade warmer than the previous record. Those are quite stunning numbers.
It's not just here in Australia, is it? Because globally, we've had record-breaking years for temperature globally. And in fact, I've heard it said that global warming is going into overdrive. Is it, in fact, speeding up?
Well, we had 2014 set a new global heat records. We had 2015, another new global hottest year on record. And now we have the beginning of 2016 coming out with these really stunning numbers. The February this year was a full 1.35 degrees warmer than the climatological baseline period in the middle of the 20th century. And up until last September, we had never had an anomaly of more than 1 degree. And now we're suddenly at 1.35 degree. That's the biggest jump upward that we have seen. That's not entirely unexpected because we have a major El Nino event ongoing in the tropical Pacific. It's now kind of slowly winding down. And we know from past experience that these El Nino events, they put an extra spike of warming on top of the long-term ongoing global warming trend, which is caused by greenhouse gases.
Stefan, what's going to be the effect of these kinds of increases? Do we really know what to expect from here?
Well, in terms of the temperature, we will see this warm spike going back again when the El Nino subsides. It's going to last a couple more months and then it will be basically over. But the much more worrying underlying warming trend will continue into the future because it is caused undoubtedly by our emissions of greenhouse gases, mainly carbon dioxide. And as long as we haven't stopped emitting carbon dioxide, this global warming will continue. And it has major impacts. We can already see this just this past month with this record temperature. We had a very severe drought in Vietnam. We had very severe drought in Zimbabwe, for example. We had this Category 5 typhoon hitting Fiji. And all these were events that caused major damage as a percentage of the GDP to these countries.
Stefan, your own country of Germany has made significant shifts away from fossil fuels towards renewable energy. Can you give the listener a sense of what's happening in Germany?
Yeah, I think the German government has for many years been very aware that we are facing a climate crisis. You could actually call it a climate emergency. And the way to stop global warming is to get out of fossil fuels. And I think Germany has made some pretty good progress together with other countries like Denmark. Just to give you a number, the gross electricity production in Germany last year came 30% from renewable sources. And that's up from nearly nothing about 15 years ago. And if you look at Europe as a whole, the investments into new electricity generating capacity in Europe last year went to 77% into renewables. So the age of fossil fuels is clearly coming to an end and investors are moving away from that and investing in renewable energy because they know that is where the future lies.
What's your view of how Australia is going? So you've been here since last year and I know you've been here before. So we've got a lot of potential here, but we've also got a lot of wealth in the form of fossil fuels in the ground. So can you see us walking away from that and how can we do it?
Well, it's a fact that in Paris in December, a climate agreement was reached to stop global warming well below 2 degrees above pre-industrial temperatures. And that simply means that about 80% of the fossil fuel reserves that we know have to remain in the ground. So there's no question about using that kind of wealth, that's sitting in the ground there. And I think Australia will also have to face up to that reality that basically coal is dying. The old coal economy is collapsing and we are seeing the emergence of a new age of renewable energies. And in fact, Australia is, of course, much better placed than Germany. Australia has vast solar energy resources, for example. In Germany, where I live, it's 54 degrees north, so it's much closer to the pole than to the equator. It's very cloudy in the Berlin area, and the solar panels on my roof are generating twice as much electricity over the year as my family uses. And Australia, of course, is far better placed to harvest solar energy and also wind energy than Germany is.
That was climate scientist Stefan Ramsdorf, interviewed in Australia by Phil Stubbs from TheEnvironmentShow.com. We're out of time for this program. Thank you for caring about your world. Please tune in to Radio EcoShock again next week.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Electronic Intifada's weekly Palestine podcast.
people who have organized within the church for years have seen the sea change.
Certainly people of faith and people who have a justice orientation see those connections and say, no, we shouldn't play such a negative role in perpetuating these criminal actions.
The Electronic Intifada.
The Electronic Intifada.
The Electronic Intifada.
This is the Electronic Intifada podcast.
I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman, and you're listening to the Electronic Intifada podcast. The Episcopal Church has formally adopted an investment screen to avoid profiting from human rights abuses against Palestinians. The church, which has more than 3 million members in the United States, passed the measure on July 13th at its general convention in Austin, Texas. According to the Episcopal Peace Fellowship Palestine-Israel Network, the passage of the resolution followed a week of passionate discussion and debate. The resolution, quote, marks a new direction for the Episcopal Church, which now joins nearly a dozen other Christian denominations, including the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, the Presbyterian Church USA, the United Methodists, and the United Church of Christ, which have all taken economic action to avoid being complicit in human rights violations and injustice in the Holy Land, says the Peace Fellowship. Delegates also adopted resolutions to safeguard the rights of Palestinian children and Palestinians in Gaza, support Palestinian self-determination, and to call for continued U.S. aid to Palestinian refugees. Finally, one resolution demands equal access to Jerusalem and opposes the Trump administration's move of the U.S. embassy to the city. Joining us to talk about the significance of the Episcopalian resolutions are Jennifer Bing and Dalit Baum of the American Friends Service Committee. Jennifer is also with the No Way to Treat a Child campaign, which presses for Israel to be held accountable for its systematic mistreatment of Palestinian children. Jennifer and Dalit, thank you so much for being with us again on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Thanks for having us.
So, Dalit, let's start with you. You were there in Austin on Friday when the resolution to adopt the human rights screen passed. Tell us about that moment and what this screening process will do for the church and for its members who want to support human rights in Palestine.
Well, I would say the Austin visit was a very wild ride. From the start, this was a 10-day meeting. From the start, people who have organized within the church for years have seen the sea change. We could see how people are stepping up to testify in favor of Palestinian rights when in past meetings they were against them. So this resolution that passes was one of a whole host of resolutions, and it was a kind of compromise in language, but not so in content. What it means operatively is that the church is going to develop a human rights screen on Israel-Palestine. In other words, the church is going to divest from companies that are involved in human rights violations as part of the Israeli occupation, just like many other denominations have done previously.
It was really, I just can't emphasize the fact that we got there and there were a dozen resolutions introduced in committees, which is kind of remarkable. At one point, somebody even asked why so many resolutions about Palestine at this convention. And I think that's because of the censorship and lack of conversation in previous conventions. So in 3 years, because the Episcopals only meet every 3 years, even the members there themselves have said a lot has happened in 3 years and a lot of eyes were opened to the injustices happening on the ground. So it really was a remarkable experience to be there.
Yeah, one of the greatest moments was actually prior to the vote by the House of Bishops. The Episcopalian Church has two houses, so it's two votes for each thing. And that was actually a whole hour discussion dedicated to divestment in the lower house, the House of Deputies. And that hour was secured after years of not getting these issues even discussed on the floor. So it was after the previous church meeting 3 years ago, people in the church have organized and asked for at least time for discussion. This was their goal. They just wanted to have time to discuss the church policy on Palestine. And so they were promised 1 hour of clean, just conversation. And that's all we wanted. And there was a 1 hour of clean conversation on divestment that resulted in a vote that was 75% in favor of divestment.
That's incredible.
It was mind-blowing.
Yes. And people were crying at the end. I mean, it all these people that have worked so hard have taken delegation after delegation of people to visit, the working the floor and talking to their deputies. And as Dalit said, you know, it's very hierarchical with the representatives. It really was like being in Congress with the House of Representatives and the Senate, and how you have to, it's all Robert's Rules of Order, and you have to be recognized to speak and all the stuff. It was incredible to witness. Dalit has been to so many conventions, she's used to it by now, but I'm always just stunned at the amount of work and energy and deliberation that goes into these kind of conversations. But again, my heart's kind of racing right now, just remembering what it was like when it was like, okay, votes are being counted, and we just were on the edge of our seats, like, okay, we did our best job to put our position forward, but you know, are people going to listen, and are they going to be afraid, or are they going to step up? And wow, they did. It was remarkable.
It was better than the World Cup.
True enough.
Dalit, can you talk a little bit about some of the misunderstandings or misinformation that's happened since the July 13th vote? There was one resolution supportive of boycott, divestment, and sanctions that did not pass at this convention. Can you talk a little bit about that and really clarify what went on here?
Yeah, I think that I think people don't realize how much work goes into these conventions and how Episcopalian all around the country have filed resolutions on these issues. We had, I think, three resolutions that were specifically about divestment from the occupation in different languages, because they came from different people in different parts of the country and dioceses. And then there were like three or four other resolutions that were about responsible investment and how the church should pay attention to human rights issues or to other ethical issues and things like that. So it might have come from people who care about other issues, not just Palestine. And so when it came to the actual legislative discussion, some of these were collapsed into one and some of them were voted on separately. So I think the confusion came from the huge success that we had early in the House of Deputies, as I described, with 75% of the deputies voting overwhelmingly for one of the more explicit resolutions that said it was titled something about church complicity in the occupation. So it's about ending church complicity and what would that mean to church investment and so on. And it was a very explicit resolution, and the House of Deputies has voted for it, 3-1. And that same resolution was later defeated by the higher house, the House of Bishops. And so there was an announcement coming out from the Episcopalian News Service saying that the church has defeated divestment. It's just that the next day, another resolution came for the vote, also passing the first house. And that one was about developing a human rights screen on Israel-Palestine, just like the ELCA, the Lutherans, have done before. And that resolution was actually debated and passed. So I think, I don't know, why would the bishops prefer one language over another? Maybe they liked it that it wasn't about church complicity so clearly. But the result of that vote is the same as would have been the first vote. In practicality, these two things say the exact same thing. They say that the church should divest. That's a screen. Screen is the same thing as like stopping your investment in something. So should divest from companies involved in human rights violations in Israel-Palestine. Things like war crimes and settlements and collective punishment and all these human rights violations. So in effect, this is the exact same resolution that passed in other denominations. And it was just confusing because of the process, I think.
Thank you. Can either of you talk about the significance of the Episcopal Church joining these other Christian denominations and standing up for Palestinian rights and joining the global campaign to divest or not invest funds in corporations that violate human rights, and what this says about the movement right now, especially as Israel and its lobbies are trying everything they can to thwart these kinds of campaigns?
I think that's a minimum. I really think that this is a baseline now for any progressive institution in the country. If you have a policy that says that you oppose the Israeli occupation of Palestine, like many of these mainline churches have had for years, yes, then you cannot continue investing in it. You cannot support it with your funds. You cannot, you know, you have to put your money where your words are. You have to align your actions with your values. This is the minimum you can do in such a dire situation. And I think many people in the church understood that.
What were some of the challenges that activists within the church were up against, and what kind of organizing tactics were useful here? I know, Jennifer, you mentioned just kind of this steady campaigning and steady education of church members. But talk a little bit more about that and what you both attribute to the success here.
Well, I think one of the things is that, as you said earlier, that activists around the country proposed different resolutions, like you mentioned earlier in the show, about Gaza, about the safeguarding the rights of Palestinian children, restoring UNRWA funding to refugees, and actually calling on an independent investigation into Israel shooting protesters at the Gaza boundary. So there were a lot of issues that were raised there, and the testimonies from outsiders, people who weren't outsiders and insiders, I should say, there were lay people from the Episcopal Church, and then people like me and Dalit and from other organizations, Palestinians and local Jewish activists who testified to committees about the conditions on the ground. So that I think this is a strategy that I think works actually in getting people to the point of talking about money and investments, is that you have to make the case for what the conditions are on the ground. And when people hear about the detention of Palestinian children, 12-year-olds getting blindfolded and handcuffed and taken away in the middle of the night and held in detention and prosecuted in military courts, that when they hear about these kind of things, then it's like, whoa, that's wrong. When they hear about the demolition of homes and the conditions in Gaza and unbearable conditions in Gaza, that all that kind of sets the stage for, and then do you want to be complicit in these actions? And, I think certainly people of faith and people who have a justice orientation see those connections and say, no, this is not the right thing to do. This shouldn't be supported by our government with military aid. We shouldn't play such a negative role in perpetuating these criminal actions.
Yeah, I would add that we see it again and again and again. We see it in universities. We saw it in other denominations. Once you get people to actually discuss the issues and hear the testimonies from Palestinians, from refugees, from Jewish Americans, from everywhere, and learn more about what it means, what is the meaning of divestment, what does it actually do, what are the companies doing on the ground, the more information people are willing to hear, the more likely they are to support divestment or even sanctions and taking whatever action needed in order to move towards peace and justice. It is always the most difficult part to get to the discussion. And many times in the past, we saw how our opposition, I would call it, was just trying to delay discussion, prevent discussion, table resolutions before they get to the floor, not allow people to testify, prevent the conversation. Because once the conversation happens, minds open and change. That's my experience.
Mm-hmm. That's the voice of Dalit Baum and Jennifer Bing. They're with the American Friends Service Committee. Let's turn for a moment and talk about the action you both were part of at a nearby immigrant detention facility in Texas, an action to protest the Trump administration's incarceration of undocumented people. I know for many of us in the Palestine activism world, the horrors of what the U.S. government and its agencies are doing at the border, ripping children away from their parents, dehumanizing them, throwing them into literal cages. This is all too familiar to the ways that Israel and its military terrorizes families and young children in Palestine. Tell us about this action and why were you both a part of it, and what parallels did you draw to what's happening in Palestine?
I would say that aside from the excitement of seeing the votes passed, that morning trip with a thousand other people, Episcopals on buses going to the Hutu detention center was probably the most emotional and powerful experience. If I could set the stage for you a little bit, like there were huge buses chartered by the Episcopal Church to take people on a 45-minute drive out to the basically middle of nowhere, which of course many of the detention centers in this country, privately run detention centers, as Dalit will remind us, was located basically in a cornfield right by a railroad track, which was a little ominous feeling. But so 1,000 people arrived on these buses. It was so hot, Texas heat. People immediately getting off the buses started singing and filled this field with signs saying the Episcopal Church is here, with signs condemning ICE and challenging our immigration policies in this country. People were singing "We Shall Overcome" in all these languages, and it was really amazing. It was, to me, that's faith in action, right? Several of us kind of left the main field and walked down this road to get closer to the entrance of the immigration center, where people started to pray and to call out, "We see you and we are here." And, you know, as we're looking a little closer at this detention center, in the windows you could see the hands of the people, of the women inside, because this is a detention facility that is holding mothers and women who are taken at the border, their hands pressed against the window. That's America today, right?
Yeah, I was also tremendously moved. I spent some of the time there with one of the activists in the Episcopal Church who actually presented one of the divestment resolutions, who helps organize the same demonstrations here in the detention center in Richmond. I'm in the Bay Area. So I've been to some of them here, and now we go all the way to Texas to the Episcopal Church, and we are standing there again, and people were crying, and people there were on their knees praying, and it was very, very powerful. It felt like, you know, sometimes I feel like we're not in an intersectional struggle. People use that word a lot. It's not. It's exact same struggle. It's the exact same thing. It is the same. It's the same sentiment. It's the same caring. It's the same corner of your heart that is activated in those moments, and you're like, we have to stop this. This is unconscionable.
I mean, I remember standing outside of the Ofer military camp, you know, outside of Ramallah, where children are held and where the military courts, quote unquote, are conducted. And while it was different there in Palestine, there are much more barbed wire fences and so forth. But the sentiment is still there. And, you know, and there are the same companies that profit from both of those systems. And it's something we all have to remember as we do our activism work.
Well, Jennifer, finally, can you tell us about the ways that the No Way to Treat a Child campaign is continuing to educate U.S. lawmakers and hold them accountable for the ongoing abuse and torture of Palestinian children in Israeli detention? Has there been any recent movement by representatives to sign on to the bill proposed by Congresswoman Betty McCollum, the Promoting Human Rights by Ending Military Detention of Palestinian Children Act? Can you give us a little bit of an update on where that bill is at right now?
Well, we're up to 30 members of Congress who signed on to this bill. And this summer we had at the end of June a congressional briefing in Washington and got a lot of new congressional offices, 58 congressional offices sent staff to attend that briefing. And we and that also led to at least one Catherine Clark in Massachusetts signing on to the bill. And so we're kind of picking them off one by one. We're hoping that this summer, as I said, I think both the divestment work and the work to move members of Congress really depends on people in their home communities doing the work of local organizing. This summer we have an opportunity, actually this summer and fall, because it's an election year. In August, Congress goes on recess, so many members of Congress will go back to their districts, hold town hall meetings. Also, many of them are running again for Congress, so they're more accessible than people needing to go to Washington, D.C. to bring up the issue of Palestinian children and Israeli military detention and ending our complicity as Americans in that horrific practice. So we're hoping that this summer we will see, and this summer and fall, more members of Congress sign on to the bill. And it's great when the Episcopal Church passes a resolution that almost word for word is from the H.R. 4391, the bill that's calling on the Secretary of State to certify that U.S. funds are not being used to detain and abuse Palestinian children's rights. So it's great to see a church affirming that same message, and we hope that that will lead to more people coming on board to the bill.
All right. Well, we're going to leave it right there. We're going to, of course, watch what happens with this bill. And again, thank you so much for being there at the Episcopal Church Convention in Austin, Texas last week. Jennifer Bing and Dalit Baum of the American Friends Service Committee. And thank you both so much for being with us on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
The Electronic Intifada.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present former CIA analyst Mel Goodman, who assesses the bizarre meeting between Donald Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin in Helsinki, and concern that critical nuclear arms control negotiations will fall victim to the 2016 U.S. election scandal. Richard Brooks of the climate justice group 350.org, who examines the significance of Ireland's parliament voting to be the first nation in the world to fully divest public funds from the fossil fuel industry. And Connecticut Governor Dana Malloy, attorney Munir Ahmed, and immigrant rights activist Vanessa Suarez, who discussed the success of a Connecticut lawsuit to reunite two Central American children with their parents and the ongoing fight to overturn Trump administration immigration policies. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
British Prime Minister Theresa May's compromise plan for Brexit, which contains customs and travel ties with the Eurozone, sparked a political crisis in the United Kingdom as pro-Brexit Foreign Minister Boris Johnson resigned along with Brexit Minister David Davis. Only hours earlier, May's cabinet rejected a white paper on Brexit written by Davis, calling for a clean break with the European Union. May later drew heavy criticism from visiting U.S. President Donald Trump, who blasted the Prime Minister's handling of Brexit in an interview with the Sun newspaper owned by Rupert Murdoch. In his resignation letter, Boris Johnson, a likely Tory challenger to May, complained the advantages of Brexit were being suffocated by needless self-doubt. Davis, who quit as May's Brexit minister, had drafted a white paper for a UK-Canadian-style free trade deal with Europe, rather than the EU-light approach taken by May and other Conservative Party members backing a soft Brexit strategy. In its Brexit plan, May's Tory government is courting big business with major operations in the EU. May promised to allow corporations to shuttle executives between the UK and EU nations with few limits. May's white paper also permits EU citizens to travel freely in Britain and to obtain temporary work permits. Overall, UK citizens are still strongly divided over the June 2016 referendum vote to leave the European Union. With the recent Janus Supreme Court ruling, which disallows public sector labor unions from charging non-union members fees to cover the cost of collective bargaining and addressing workplace grievances, the right-wing network that brought the case is now canvassing union households, urging members to opt out of paying union dues and save hundreds of dollars a year. SEIU Local Union 925 in Washington State was the target of an opt-out campaign run by the right-wing State Policy Network, funded by the billionaire Koch brothers' political network. After Janus, the fate of public sector unions is at risk, and right-wing groups are promoting opt-out campaigns to defund unions. Such campaigns are being organized in blue states, including California, Illinois, and New York. Right-wing groups were successful in obtaining lists of current union members' names and addresses through public record requests. Canvassers then went door-to-door to convince union members to opt out of paying dues. SEIU 925 lost two-thirds of its members through such campaigns. The challenge now facing many public employee unions after decades of demobilization is to learn how to break away from business-as-usual unionism and enlist their members and the community to resist. They will have to do this with fewer staff and resources than before. Connecticut inmate Robert Pratt shared a special ceremony at his community college graduation with fellow prisoners in a program funded by the Obama-era Second Chance Pell Grants, which provides financial aid to inmates. 27 states now offer these Pell Grants with the goal of ending the cycle of prison recidivism. According to the Vera Institute for Justice in New York, similar experimental prisoner education programs run 3 to 5 years. With the ongoing crisis of mass incarceration, several bipartisan initiatives are supporting prison reform programs. The Republican-controlled House of Representatives recently passed the First Step Act, which incentivizes prisoners to participate in rehabilitation programs with the possibility of earlier release. Margaret DiZarega, a project director at the Vera Institute, says, "We see that across the political system, there's a general sense that if we provide more education, including post-secondary education, to people in prison, we will have better public safety outcomes." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
The Helsinki summit between Donald Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin will be remembered as one of the most bizarre in American presidential history. Following a two-hour meeting between the two leaders with only interpreters present, Trump and Putin held a press conference. There, Mr. Trump stunned the world by once again casting doubt on U.S. intelligence agencies' conclusion that Russia was responsible for meddling on behalf of Trump in the 2016 U.S. election, while insisting that Putin's denials were credible. The president also condemned Special Counsel Robert Mueller's probe, calling it a disaster for our country. The summit took place just a few days after Trump's own Justice Department indicted 12 Russian intelligence officers on charges that they had hacked into the Democratic National Committee's computer and released embarrassing information regarding Hillary Clinton and the Democratic Party staff attempt to help Hillary Clinton against Bernie Sanders during the primary campaign. Although it's not certain what Trump and Putin discussed during their two-hour private meeting, it's doubtful that major issues causing friction between the two nations, including the war in Syria, Ukraine, and arms control agreements, were substantively addressed. Your reporter spoke with Mel Goodman, a former CIA analyst at the Office of Soviet Affairs and author who currently serves as a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy. Here, Goodman assesses the strange meeting between Trump and Putin and expresses concern that critical nuclear arms control negotiations may fall victim to the 2016 U.S. election scandal.
You know, when you think of the 100 years of history of Soviet-American and now Russian-American relations, this has to be the most bizarre, surreal single day of that relationship. The fact that Donald Trump, before he even arrived in Helsinki, referred to our European allies as foes of the United States, and his personal attacks, interestingly enough, on the two female heads of state at the European meetings, Merkel and May. He is a bully. He does love to pick on women, even those women who happen to be heads of state, setting up a meeting with Vladimir Putin when he had a chance to decide on advice that was given to him by his intelligence czar, Dan Coats, and he basically distanced himself from the intelligence czar and said he agrees with Vladimir Putin on the Russian hacking and the Russian penetration in the American presidential election. And I guess what I find so disconcerting, and so much of this is disconcerting, is that I believe that there is need to reestablish the Russian-American dialogue. You know, a great opportunity was lost in 1991, with the collapse of the Soviet Union. I think the United States made mistakes in the wake of that collapse, particularly the expansion of NATO, which is responsible for a lot of the turmoil today, the abrogation of the anti-ballistic missile treaty, the deployment of a missile defense in Poland and Romania, the way we handled the Libyan situation, the attacks on Serbia in 1999. I mean, there is an agenda that Putin is concerned with. I don't think he should be demonized to the extent that he's responsible for the terrible situation we're in now, but it does need to be corrected with an institutionalized dialogue. But you don't institutionalize dialogue by starting at the top of the leadership chain, meeting between heads of state. And this meeting was totally bizarre. Others have used words like disgraceful and embarrassing, and I have happened to share that view, because basically Trump not only pursued a policy of America first, he really isolated the United States, coming down so hard on the side of Vladimir Putin and ignoring all the bilateral issues, the security issues, the regional issues that could have been part of a discussion. But there was no sign whatsoever that the Trump administration prepared for any of this discussion. There were no National Security Council meetings. There were no secondary meetings by assistant secretaries of state, assistant secretaries of defense, to prepare for this meeting at the top. And as a result, it begs the question about what is going to follow this bizarre meeting that has all of Washington enraged, even some Republicans. And it's about time for that. But I think he has taken a problem and now probably has created a political crisis for himself.
U.S.-Russia relations are very rocky in the last several years, as noted by both Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin. And there are critical issues afoot between the U.S. and Russia, including the conflict in Syria, Crimea, and Ukraine. But probably most importantly, the arms control issues, the nuclear weapons that are operated by the United States and Russia. There's the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, and the very important issue
of negotiations necessary to extend the New START treaty, which will expire in about 2.5 years. What's the danger of domestic U.S. politics and the stoking up of a new Cold War with Russia endangering these critical arms control issues in particular?
Well, I think there's a real risk there, and that would be the unfortunate thing, that if we would lose any possibility of re-engaging on these issues, because, as you say, the INF Treaty, which is one of the most important arms control agreements, most important disarmament agreements that the United States has ever signed. I mean, this was a treaty that banned an entire range of missile systems, the short-range, intermediate-range missile systems from 500 to several thousand kilometers. That was reduced to zero on both sides. And each side now has charges of conflict, of attempts to skirt around the dictates of that agreement. We have concerns about some sophisticated cruise missiles that have been tested. And certainly they have concerns about our regional missile defense that we're put into Poland and Romania that I think violates the spirit of the treaty. So we need to get back to the table on that, just as we need to get back to the table on the New START treaty, which is the longer range systems. And that agreement is also in trouble because Obama, in order to get that treaty ratified, had to agree to a huge increase in spending on nuclear weapons modernization, which is the last thing this country needs. And if we lose the momentum of the relationship because of the way Trump has handled himself, which I think will fire up the Congress, and I expect there will be bipartisan agreement on increasing sanctions, if nothing else, in order to tell Donald Trump that he really crossed a line in Helsinki. So the baby will be thrown out with the bathwater in this case, because I think the INF treaty will become more controversial, and we won't see that follow-on to the New START treaty from 2010.
That was Mel Goodman, a former CIA analyst and author, who currently serves as a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy. His new book, American Carnage, The Wars of Donald Trump, will be published later this year. For more analysis and commentary on the Helsinki summit meeting, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The nation of Ireland is set to become the first nation in the world to fully divest public funds from investment in the fossil fuel industry. Divestment legislation was approved by the Irish lower house on July 12th and now awaits approval by the country's Senate. Ireland's $10.4 billion strategic investment fund had approximately $371 million invested in fossil fuel companies last year. The bill mandates divestment from fossil fuel corporations within 5 years and bars future investments in the industry. Those working to divest believe that reducing the flow of money to oil, coal, and gas companies will help curb expensive new drilling and mining projects to extract fossil fuels that produce carbon and greenhouse gas that contribute to climate change. While some climate activists believe they can be more effective by working from the inside as shareholders to change corporate policies, worldwide divestment campaigns are growing by leaps and bounds. Nations, including Norway, are moving toward full divestment, and New York City recently announced it plans to divest their $189 billion pension fund from fossil fuel companies within the next 5 years. Your reporter spoke with Richard Brooks, North America Iconic Divestment Campaigns Coordinator with the climate justice group 350.org. Here he examines the significance of Ireland's fossil fuel divestment and provides an update on other divestment campaigns being undertaken in cities, states, religious institutions, corporations, and universities.
The campaign in Ireland to push the Irish government to divest from fossil fuels has been running for several years, and it culminated in the fall of 2016 when one of the independent deputies who sits in the lower house of the parliament in Ireland introduced the Fossil Fuel Divestment Act. And this bill took about almost 2 years to work its way through various committees and votes, with pressure building on the outside, to eventually we got this vote that happened last week, where the lower house of the Irish Parliament passed the Fossil Fuel Divestment Act, making Ireland the first country in the world to commit its public funds to divest from fossil fuels entirely. This was a very much a grassroots-led campaign, We had thousands of people who signed petitions asking their elected officials in Ireland to move forward and support this legislation. That included faith groups and student groups, Trocare, which is an Irish Catholic aid group, which was set up by the bishops of Ireland many years ago, was actually one of the groups that very much led this campaign. They do a lot of development work in countries that are heavily affected by climate change, particularly in East Africa. Dozens of committee representations, lots of protests, very creative actions were happening. And eventually it gathered support from all parties in Ireland, resulted last week in this passing of the bill across party lines, which was great to see.
Richard, there are hundreds of divestment projects all across the world, and I wonder if you would run down some of the most significant campaigns now being waged to divest public funds from the fossil fuel industry, including nations, cities, states, corporations, religious institutions, and universities, who all have experienced some movement in this direction.
So some really great examples of where there's been success across these different institutional sectors includes the Rockefeller Family Fund. The Rockefeller Family Fund was one of the early foundations, charitable foundations, that decided to divest. And the Rockefellers, one of the wealthiest families in the world, their wealth was built upon investments in the oil industry. They were the founders of Standard Oil, which later became ExxonMobil. For a family like that, or for a foundation like that, to move away from the fossil fuel industry, I think really speaks volumes to the importance of taking real action on climate change. New York City is another great example where there was a very long-standing, a five-year campaign to push elected officials in New York City to divest the city pension funds. The city pension funds in New York City total almost $200 billion, one of the largest pension funds in the United States. And in January, the mayor with the comptroller stood up at a press conference and said, we are taking real action. We're getting out of fossil fuel companies, and we're going to take one more step. We're going to sue the largest fossil fuel companies for the damages that they are causing to our city and the costs that we're going to have to expend to mitigate against the impacts of climate change. Pretty significant. I think the divestment movement created the space for these climate lawsuits to begin to be launched right across the country. Caritas, which is one of the largest Catholic development agencies in the world, just recently announced that they were going to be divesting from fossil fuels. And I think we're seeing the beginnings of the steps towards the actual Vatican divesting from fossil fuels, which would be monumental and very important to a very large portion of the world's population. The World Council of Churches is another organization that was an early adopter of fossil fuel divestment and made commitments to divest the churches in that council. So I think we're seeing right across the board very significant developments and announcements and commitments, and it's very inspiring, and I hope it's inspiring to others to join in. There's clearly momentum as we are building more and more institutions making these divestment commitments.
That was Richard Brooks, North America Iconic Divestment Campaigns Coordinator with the climate justice group 350.org. Learn more about worldwide fossil fuel divestment campaigns by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Several days after attorneys in Connecticut filed lawsuits on behalf of two immigrant children who were separated from their parents at the U.S. border and brought to Connecticut, a federal judge on July 13th ruled that the separation was unconstitutional, and the two families were reunited 3 days later. The families, one from El Salvador and the other from Honduras, are now receiving legal, social, and emotional support as they consider their next steps. While the court victory was cause for celebration, speakers at a press conference on July 17th noted that most of the 3,000 other children separated from their parents have not yet been reunited, and it appears the goal of the Trump administration is to deport entire families back to the violence they fled once they are reunited. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus covered the press conference at the Yale Law School in New Haven
and presents excerpts from some of the speakers there. We hear first from Connecticut Governor Daniel Malloy, who said he was glad the children were brought to his state, where there are public and private legal resources that are available to those in need. He also described the Trump administration as sadistic.
So the offices necessary to process refugee status cases at the border were purposefully understaffed and frequently closed so that people who had legitimate claims could not make them. Given the option of death or coming across the border, having tried to file refugee status and having heard hundreds of times that those claims were not being processed in contravention of a 1951 treaty that the United States entered into, sponsored by the UN, and as a result of the failure to properly relocate people following the Second World War, we were, in fact, in violation of that treaty. And quite frankly, if we were brought to an appropriate court, we would be found to be in violation of that. This is a government that has made it impossible, or nearly impossible, for thousands of individuals to seek that status, and then blames them for not having that status. So that's a point that absolutely has to be understood. Because coming out of Washington, coming out of this administration, is the blaming of people who are otherwise would qualify for legitimate refugee status. So you really need to understand that we're the country that's in violation of our 1951 obligations, not someone else, and certainly not these thousands of individuals who have over the last number of months been thwarted in their attempts to file those kinds of claims. Listen, what's going on as a matter of United States policy is nothing short of political sadism. It was designed to inflict pain on children and parents to receive joy. The joy that they thought they would get was that this would stop people from coming to our borders seeking a refugee status or immigration status. That's what the joy was that caused this sadism to be part of our national policy. They have found out that that joy was short-lived. It backfired. I think tremendously on them, although I'm sure that there are folks who think it makes sense to be cruel to children, but it was nothing less than political sadism.
Munir Ahmed is co-director of the Worker and Immigrant Rights Advocacy Clinic at Yale Law School, which, along with Connecticut Legal Services, filed the lawsuits.
We hope that what we've been able to do over the last 2 weeks, which is the duration of this litigation, is to establish a kind of Connecticut model. A coalition of lawyers, law schools, community legal services, community advocates, and elected officials who stand and act in unison, make demands for justice inside the courtroom and outside the courtroom, and do that on behalf of children. We think that we were successful here in Connecticut in that short period of time because there were people of good conscience who found ways to work together, and we think that can be done across the country.
Another attorney injected a note of caution, saying that most public funding for legal aid excludes these types of cases, so privately funded groups in other states must step up if similar results are to be achieved. Another speaker was Vanessa Suarez with the immigrant rights groups Unidad Latina en Acción and Connecticut Immigrant Rights Alliance.
This is a tremendous victory for the community. We are very happy to see that these families have been reunited and have been granted freedom. We do not believe in cages, and we do not believe in borders. We believe that every human being has the right to migrate without being detained or separated from their families. Migration is natural and courses through the blood of all life on Earth. While we celebrate the reunification of these two children with their parents, we acknowledge that the fight is not over. Thousands of children are separated from their parents due to this administration's inhumane and cruel zero-tolerance policy. For decades, our migrant brothers and sisters have experienced various forms of violence at the hands of this government. We must acknowledge the pain that has been inflicted and the generational trauma that exists. In his ruling, the judge acknowledged that there was an irreparable harm caused. And so I ask, how can our people begin to heal when the government continues to terrorize our communities? That is why we say abolish ICE. ICE violates human rights every day and is accountable to no one. If this message reaches some of the families who are still detained, we want you to know that there is an entire community fighting for and with you. You are not alone. We will continue to fight every day until every family is freed and reunited. We will not rest until we have justice and freedom. No more violence. We call for an end to the criminalization, caging, and detention of our people. No more deportations. As a community, we must continue to support each other. We recognize that it takes a village to heal a generational trauma. We do this through solidarity, love, support, and by lifting the voices of our brothers and sisters. Because when we fight, we win. And together, we will create a world where our people are free and can live with dignity. Thank you.
That was Vanessa Suarez with the immigrant rights groups Unidad Latina and Acción and the Connecticut Immigrant Rights Alliance. Munir Ahmed, co-director of the Worker and Immigrant Rights Advocacy Clinic at Yale Law School, preceded by Connecticut Governor Daniel Malloy. Find more information on this case and commentary on the Trump administration's zero-tolerance immigration policy by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our newly designed and mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WESU in Middletown, Connecticut, WDRT in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, KRFY in Sandpoint, Idaho, and more than 60 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jamal's radio essay.
This is an excerpt from the book Murder Incorporated, Dreaming of Empire, Book 1, by Mumia Abu-Jamal and Stephen Vittoria. Philosophizing Disgrace. Throughout mankind's history, the same elite mindset that terrorizes with slavery terrorizes with war. Terrorism is terrorism. Genocide, Holocaust, war, slavery, poverty, denial of health care, denial of education, wanton destruction of the planet's resources. It's all the same witch's brew. Terrorize the flesh, terrorize the spirit. As the soi-disant civilized Anglo-Saxons followed the sun, venturing west with their insatiable desire to expand and take possession, war on demon savages was the operating principle of imperial conquest, ultimately a common practice that remains so to this day. Europeans often use the fact that slavery also existed in various African states at the same time as a way to further justify their own slave trade, even beyond the warped divine notion of civilized master ruling the savage slave. In fact, to this day, there are segments of the ruling class and their errand boys who continue to perpetuate this perverted point of view. In A People's History of the United States, Professor Howard Zinn distinguishes American slavery from African slavery of the same period. Slavery existed in the African states and it was sometimes used by Europeans to justify their own slave trade. But as Basil Davidson points out in his book, The African Slave Trade, the slaves of Africa were more like the serfs of Europe. In other words, like most of the population of Europe. It was a harsh servitude, but they had rights which slaves brought to America did not have, and they were altogether different from the human cattle of the slave ships and the American plantations. Zen goes on to note that in the Ashanti Kingdom, which was located on the western coast of Africa, a slave could marry, own property, swear an oath, be a witness, and even become a beneficiary to his master. Zen concludes, African slavery is hardly to be praised, but it was far different from plantation or mining slavery in the Americas, which was lifelong, morally crippling, destructive of family ties, without hope of any future. African slavery lacked two elements that made American slavery the most cruel form of slavery in history: the frenzy for limitless profit that comes from capitalistic agriculture, the reduction of the slave to less than human status by the use of racial hatred, with that relentless clarity based on color, where white was master, black was slave. Absolute power corrupts absolutely. Madness eats away at the soul of men who play God, like Kurtz in Heart of Darkness, as well as Walt Kurtz in the jungles of Indochina. The temptation to play God becomes the bad acid trip that triggers savage barbarity. In the same fashion, the cancer of American slavery also devoured the hearts and minds of the slave owner. Frederick Douglass explains how his mistress, his owner, Mrs. Auld, was summarily transformed from a kind and compassionate woman to a malevolent tyrant. Quote, "The fatal poison of irresponsible power was also in her hands, and soon commenced its infernal work. That cheerful eye, under the influence of slavery, soon became red with rage. That voice, made all of sweet accord, changed to one of harsh and horrid discord, and that angelic face gave place to that of a demon." Unquote. Frederick Douglass. You've been listening to an excerpt from Murder Incorporated, Book 1, Dreaming of Empire, by Mumia Abu-Jamal and Stephen Vittoria. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. Ugly American Abroad. The political reality of American President Donald Trump on the world stage is a sight to behold. Bold, brash, as opinionated as he is uninformed, Trump moves in global spaces like King Kong, bringing destruction and devastation no matter which way he turns. His opinions, drawn from the bottom shelves of the U.S. right wing, are really frantic prayers to return to yesteryear, the good old days of the 1950s, when white men ruled and all the rest were silent. Elected basically as a reaction to the Obama election, Trump's sole appeal is his whiteness, not his ideas. As for ideas, he has none, save a sad request for times gone by. His politics, the politics best represented by the elderly comic Don Rickles, for like Rickles, his is the politics of insult. Wherever he goes, his insults precede or follow as he attacks Britain's Theresa May, Germany's Angela Merkel, or Emmanuel Macron of France. The EU is a foe, according to Trump, and only Putin's Russia deserves respect, for its leader is strong. It may surprise some, but truth be told, Trump is America's truest face. His grim visage, his air of disdain for all other countries. Well, this is America. Fearful of strangers, small, petty, and pretentious. This is America, not the urbane, witty, sophisticated Obama. America, the empire, needs no allies nor friends, needs only supplicants, foes, satraps, and colonies. From imprisoned nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Welcome to the Global Research News Hour Summer Series. My name is Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a weekly public affairs broadcast produced at CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada, on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation, in partnership with the Center for Research on Globalization. Our shows air on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States and are podcast at the website globalresearch.ca. This week, we are airing excerpts from a talk called My Jerusalem, Responding to the U.S. Embassy Announcement. My Jerusalem was presented at the University of Winnipeg on February 28, 2018. The discussion included panelists coming from the three great faith traditions, a Jewish rabbi, a Palestine-Canadian Muslim, and a Palestine-Canadian Christian, all of which claim some intimate connection with the historic city of Jerusalem. The occasion for the event was President Trump's decision to move the U.S. Embassy in Israel to Jerusalem. As we will hear, the move broke with an international consensus that the Holy City deserves special distinction as a site that accommodates both Israeli Jews and Palestinians, both Christian and Muslim. The My Jerusalem discussion was sponsored by a number of local organizations, including the Canadian Arab Association of Manitoba, the University of Winnipeg's Global College, Independent Jewish Voices, Winnipeg, the Mennonite Central Committee, Manitoba, and Peace Alliance Winnipeg, among others. Before the main speaker's presentation, Esther Epteason, a Winnipeg-based MCC representative and trained historian, presented an overview of the historic trajectory of Jerusalem in the Israeli context.
Until the end of World War I, Palestine had been for 400 years under the control of the Ottoman Empire. After World War I, Palestine came under British control, and it was known as Mandate Palestine from 1920 until 1948. Jerusalem, the population of Jerusalem was about 60,000 in the early 20s. It grew to 160,000 by 1946. That growth was due primarily to Jewish immigration. By 1946, there were about 100,000 Jews, 31 Christians, and 34 Muslims living in the city. Over the years of the British Mandate, tensions grew between Palestinian Arabs, who were longtime residents of the area, Jews, who were largely more recent immigrants, as well as the British administration. Significant violence occurred through the 1930s and the 1940s, some of it perpetrated by Palestinians, some of it perpetrated by Zionist militias, and a good bit of it aimed at the British. So much so that by the end of World War II, Britain was very eager to offload Palestine. And the newly created United Nations established a committee, a special committee on Palestine, to figure out what to do. That committee was headed by none other than Lester B. Pearson. And the committee developed a partition plan, which was passed, brought to the General Assembly, and passed on the 29th of November, 1947, passed by a vote of 33-13. The partition plan proposed to divide the land of Mandate Palestine into two states, a Jewish state with about 56% of the land, and an Arab or Palestinian state with about 44% of the land. Jerusalem was to be an international zone. You can perhaps see that little spot right there. That's Jerusalem, an international zone. That was the proposal. A corpus separatum, it was called, to be administered for 10 years by the United Nations, at the end of which time there was to be a referendum to determine the future of Jerusalem. The area for this international zone was actually quite large, significantly larger than the municipal boundaries of Jerusalem under the British. The UN partition plan never went into effect because of the war that ensued. But the important thing about that plan was that through it, the international community identified Jerusalem as a special place deserving of special consideration. British forces left Mandate Palestine on May 14, 1948, and Israel declared independence at midnight that night. Zionist militias had already begun to expel Palestinians from their visit prior to that, but immediately after the declaration, a volunteer army from surrounding Arab countries engaged with the Israeli forces. And that war continued through to the end of 1948. This, I apologize for the blur in this particular map. This is what it looked like at the end of that war. Israel was significantly larger, and the areas that we would know today, West Bank, Gaza, and so on, were West Bank was part of Jordan, Gaza was part of Egypt, and so on. So as the war drew to a close in late 1948, Israeli and Jordanian military generals met and drew a ceasefire line through the city of Jerusalem. It was a rough line. It cut through streets, through neighborhoods. It was not very well planned. It was intended to be temporary, but it actually became part of the armistice line in 1949. So you can see that green line passing through the city of Jerusalem. The yellow part, East Jerusalem under Jordanian control, the blue part, West Jerusalem under Israeli control. This 7-kilometer city line, as it was called, divided the city with walls, barbed wires, military fortifications, sniper positions. And I should mention that there was a good deal of violence in Jerusalem during those the months leading up to the ceasefire in November 48. Hardly any Arab Palestinians remained in West Jerusalem. Hardly any Jews remained in East Jerusalem. They were either expelled either direction or they were killed. So much tragedy during 1948. And hence the fortifications and so on. All of the old city was part of East Jerusalem and under Jordanian control.
So henceforth, Jews were not allowed into the Old City. They were not allowed to visit the Western Wall, which is a very important religious site. They were not allowed to visit the Jewish cemetery that was on the eastern part of the, outside the eastern border of the Old City. West Jerusalem was named the capital of Israel, but East Jerusalem was not named the capital of Jordan. It was simply East Jerusalem. Through the 1950s, a variety of parties continued to put forth proposals to establish Jerusalem as an international city. Proposals came from the British, from the US, from the UN. So there were parties that continued to hold on to this vision of Jerusalem under some kind of international administration. But it became clear after a number of years that Israel and Jordan were at least reasonably satisfied with the status quo for the time being, and so nothing further happened. Until 1967. In 1967, in a short six-day war in June, Israel gained control of the rest of Mandate Palestine. So that was Gaza, along the Mediterranean, the Golan Heights, the West Bank, and East Jerusalem. In Jerusalem, that wall along the Green Line came down. People could move around. Jews could visit the Western Wall and the cemetery once again. There was great rejoicing among the Israeli community at the reunification of the city after 19 years of division. Israel took quick action to extend the Jerusalem municipal borders. East Jerusalem was placed under the law, jurisdiction, and administration of Israel. Palestinians in East Jerusalem were granted Jerusalem ID cards. And Palestinians wondered, what would this all mean? The UN Security Council took action. It condemned Israel's acquisition of this additional territory through force and demanded that it withdraw from these territories. It also emphasized the need to work for a just and lasting peace in the Middle East, in which every state, Israel and its neighbors, could live in security. This action, this UN Security Council Resolution 242, became and continues to be the key UN resolution which defines the international community's stance on Israel's presence in the region. In 1980, the Israeli Knesset passed the Jerusalem Law, which identified the city as complete and united and as the capital of Israel, and it effectively annexed the entire city. This was again criticized by the United Nations as a violation of international law. Some countries had moved their embassies to Jerusalem in the intervening years, but the UN encouraged them to remove their embassies back to Tel Aviv, and many of them did so. During the 1980s, 70s and 80s, Palestinian resistance grew, erupting in the First Intifada in 1987. And it was also during this time that Palestinians increasingly came to regard East Jerusalem as the capital of what they hoped for their future state. Oslo. In 1993 and 1995, Israel and the Palestine Liberation Organization signed the Oslo Accords. This was the first time that Israel and the PLO acknowledged each other and agreed to negotiate a peace settlement. Not a peace treaty, but a framework that would hopefully lead to a peace treaty down the road. Oslo transferred control of major Palestinian cities in the West Bank and Gaza from Israeli military to a newly created Palestinian Authority, an interim structure. And the hope was that limited Palestinian self-government and incremental Israeli withdrawal would boost mutual support, and that would empower leaders on both sides to negotiate final status issues. So you can see here something of what was called Area ABC, the division of the West Bank there, the yellow areas in the West Bank denoting Area A, where Palestinians had full control. Area B is the green, where there was joint control with area with Israeli authorities, and the white area would be Area C, which remained within Israeli control. But this was, at the time it was signed, considered to be a temporary measure. The as I indicated, the hope was that by 1999, things would be well on the way, and also final status issues would be resolved. And those final status issues were Palestinian refugees, Israeli settlements, border and security, and, of course, the status of Jerusalem. There was much excitement around Oslo at first, but that excitement dissipated over subsequent years. And why was that? Because of facts on the ground. Facts on the ground included Israeli demolition of Palestinian homes and villages due to lack of Israeli-granted permits, planning systems and so on made the obtaining of building permits extremely difficult for Palestinians. Construction of Jewish-only settlements in East Jerusalem and West Bank. All of these Jewish settlement building had been going on for some time already, but that escalated in the years after Oslo. And then there was also the building of the wall. In 2002, Israel began construction of a separation barrier through the West Bank and East Jerusalem, 700 kilometers long. It weaves its way through the West Bank, around the West Bank, and also it carves up Jerusalem. It separates Palestinians from Israelis, but also from each other. It cuts off roads and services. It prevents people from reaching their holy places for worship. It harms businesses, and it turns some neighborhoods into ghost towns. In 2004, the International Court of Justice issued a ruling that the wall is illegal where it's built on Palestinian land, but it still stands. And Jerusalem is more divided than ever. The point of all this is that there's a long-standing international consensus that Jerusalem is a special place, a place to be shared. In the last several decades, there's been a moving away from the idea of Jerusalem as an international administered place, but it continues to be the view that Jerusalem should be a place where two peoples embracing three faiths should be able to live and work and to worship and access their holy sites. It's a place whose future should be negotiated between the peoples who live there, Israelis and Palestinians. And so it is this international consensus that has been broken by the actions of the Donald Trump administration after many decades. And that's the situation we are in now. So I'll leave it at that.
Rabbi David Mifeser has been engaged on Israel-Palestine for half a century. Active with independent Jewish voices in Canada, he sits on the Rabbinic Council of Jewish Voices for Peace in the U.S. and is Rabbi Emeritus of the Ahavat Olam Synagogue in Vancouver, where he lives. Here is some of what he had to say on the subject of my Jerusalem.
My second year of university, I went off to Jerusalem for a year of university. And I can say now, I think my parents were like just completely bewildered. You know, like, where did they go wrong? What happened to this child that they thought they were raising to be a somewhat normal person? You know, went off the path and did this crazy thing. So I went to Jerusalem as a 19-year-old. And, you know, maybe I can just use some references. I had read the book Exodus. Does that mean something to you? I saw the movie, Exodus. I read the book, The Source. These very kind of romantic images, you know, plus the prayers, plus the Bible, plus all this stuff. And I remember the day I got there, I wanted to just walk down the street and, like, hug everybody. It's like, I'm here. I finally, like, wow, I'm in Jerusalem. I'm, you know, shalom, everybody. I'm, you know, most other people weren't feeling that at that particular moment. But it was so exciting for me. And it was a great time of discovery. I found it fascinating and fabulous. Part of what it was about for me was feeling myself being part of, like, the ingathering of the Jewish people. After 2,000 years, there were, you know, there was Jews from Kurdistan, there were Jews from Yemen, Jews from Morocco, Jews from the places like where my great-grandparents lived, like Poland, Russia, whatever. Wow, we're all there. And there was these Palestinians that they lived there, like, all the time. There were their churches, mosques. And I felt a very, very strong kinship. I'm not kidding. Like, my cousins, you know, like, kind of like they stayed. We left and came back. We're all here together, you know. And that was just, like, overwhelmingly exciting and powerful for me. I lived on the top of Mount Scopus, which actually, in one of the maps that you just saw, it was a little enclave carved out in the ceasefire. And the ceasefire was, like, drew lines in 1949 because the Hebrew University was there. The Hebrew University was founded in 1926 or maybe 24. Albert Einstein was part of it. It was part of the Zionist project of creating a Jewish homeland. It was there. It got cut off from the rest of the city. And then in 1967, it was a heroic war. The Israelis were able to reunify the city. I lived there. And I heard songs and poems about literally, like, sitting on the top of Mount Scopus, dreaming of Jerusalem for 2,000 years, and here I am. I could go on with this for a long time talking with you, but I don't have so long. I have other memories from that time of my life. Can you tell me how much time I do have? I'm not too good at keeping time. That's how much I've left. That's incredible. Okay. I just want to tell you some other things I remember. I remember one of the first days I was in Jerusalem, walking down Jaffa Road, with, you know, stone buildings with stores. Jaffa Road was the main road into the old city of Jerusalem that went down to the seacoast of Jaffa. I imagine that road's been there probably for 3,000 or 4,000 years. I imagine it was a very mixed place with Arab shops, Jewish shops. When I was there, it was all Jewish. And there was, I remember, a little boy with a bad cut on his hand. His hand was bleeding, and he was crying. He was very distressed. And I was a 19-year-old American who had been there for maybe 3 or 4 days. I went to this little boy, and I could tell he was an Arab boy. I knew, like, maybe one or two words of Arabic, and he's crying, and there were some policemen. And me, a good American kid, it's like the policeman is your friend, right? If you get hurt, the policeman will help you, of course. So I remember, I said, Imshi, you know, come, I think that means come with me or something. What? Well, I don't know what it means. I heard people saying it, and people started doing it. Imshi. So I took this little boy to the police, and I said, you know, I could speak enough Hebrew. I said, help him. Like, why aren't you helping him? And this person's like, what are you doing? He's an Arab. Don't you know this is an Arab kid? You know, they use horrible language. You know, get him out of here. What'd you bring him here for? And so that, too, was part of my experience in Jerusalem. I saw with my own eyes dispossession, literally people being dispossessed from their homes. Living on the top of Mount Scopus, right over the crest of the hill, there's a large Arab town called Isawiya. Issa means Jesus. It's a town connected to Jesus' own life. It was a big Arab town. And when I was there, again, 19-year-old naive guy, I knew that Israel just expropriated so much of that land, just took it. Of course, in the Israeli mind, they offered them a fair market price, and the landowners didn't accept it. They didn't want to sell their land. So Israel did what might happen here. What's it called when the government takes land to build a dam or a road? There's a word for it. Anyway, I saw that happen. The 1 year I was there, Israel started building these high-rise apartment buildings, almost like a giant tank barrier to plant Jews. So this would never go back to that village, ever. I saw that go on. Something I remember very well was the Western Wall, which is a retaining wall from the time of the temple, built by King Herod. We say it's the holiest place in Judaism. It's a place that Jews go and pray. It was called by Christians the Wailing Wall because they thought the Jews were wailing while they're praying. I remember going there many, many, many times and sometimes dancing like ecstatically with other Jewish people being there, feeling like I'm in this place where my ancestors worshipped for, literally since the time of the Bible. And to get there, I walked from Mount Scopus on these kind of curving roads, down the hills, through neighborhoods like Wadi Joz and Sheikh Jarrah, and that's where Idris grew up. I was there before you were born, probably, but my experience was walking by, and there's, Arab people sitting out on their porch, I don't know what, eating something or hanging out with their family, saying hello to me as I walked by. It was beautiful. I felt a lot of goodwill. I actually felt a kind of a welcome. I said this earlier while we were having dinner. This was 4 years after the Six-Day War, meaning 4 years after 19 years of division with those barbed wire and the no man's land and machine gun posts. All that was gone. And I had this tremendous feeling of optimism, somehow we were all going to end up living together. Anyway, I need to speed this up quite a bit. 2 minutes. Okay. So since then, so much has changed. The dispossession has increased. I think it's almost shocking to say, but Palestinian existence in Jerusalem, I think, is threatened just little by little, house by house, block by block, neighborhood by neighborhood. It's being taken away from them. And at the same time, Israel is building ring after ring of Jewish settlements and neighborhoods all around it. The places that were first built when I was there, I just told you about, they've been there almost 50 years now. There's second and third generation Israelis that don't even realize they're new. I could talk so much about that. That wall that at that time I thought it was the center of holiness, to me right now it feels blasphemous to think that those stones are somehow holy and that it's okay to destroy other people's homes, you can dance there. That's just completely backwards. It's a kind of, I don't know, I don't have the right vocabulary for it right now, but it's just such an inversion. I've been back to Jerusalem in recent years. I don't want to go there. I find for me now, Jerusalem feels almost an insane place, that people are so caught up in their own ideas, what they imagine, that it's hard for them to see the reality that they're creating, that they're living in. So I'm just going to jump and say quickly my thoughts about the Trump administration saying that it recognizes Jerusalem as the capital of the state of Israel. This may be glib or not well-founded. I don't think it matters very much. I think life in that city has been contested and very difficult for Palestinians There's such a drive and an impulse by Israelis to dominate and subjugate that's been so prevalent for more than 50 years. I think the impact of the U.S. making that decision, which I think the whole world recognizes as being erratic, irresponsible kind of decision, it reinforces the Israeli expectation that they're going to be able to continue that. But I think, perhaps I have some kind of faith that ultimately something else is going to kick in and change what happens on the ground. The Palestinians are tremendously tenacious, and I think politics is very, what's the word for it, like mercurial. Things can go this way, things can go that way. Policies change, governments change. So I don't see that itself as such a great kind of sea change or a precipitous new kind of circumstances that we're in. I think it's actually like just an incremental continuation of what's been going on really since 1948. And I, just in the interest of time, I'll wrap up my presentation right here, and with great interest look forward to hearing from Fadi and from Idris.
My name is Michael Welch, and you're listening to the Global Research News Hour, airing on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States. The show is podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. Today, as part of our summer series, we're airing a talk at the University of Winnipeg presented February 28, 2018, entitled My Jerusalem, Responding to the U.S. Embassy Announcement. The event showcased speakers representing Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, speaking to their personal connections to Jerusalem and their appraisals of the implications of the U.S. administration's announcement to move its embassy there. Idris El-Bakri is a Palestinian who was born and raised in the holy city of Jerusalem. He moved to the U.S. after high school in pursuit of higher education and settled in Winnipeg with his family in 2005. What follows is an excerpt from his presentation.
The Jerusalem of my past is the Jerusalem of the first Intifada. When that took place, I was in my early teens. So we were couldn't go to school for many, many months. There were many strikes. The youth and the army would clash regularly, almost daily, and there would be casualties almost daily. It was a time when we couldn't afford many things. We lived off of our savings as a family, and it was a time when the Israeli army had the policy of breaking the bones. I remember very, very clearly the footage of the army capturing some Palestinian youth and basically using rocks to break the bones in their shoulders. And probably it was the Intifada's fault that I'm here today, because as I finished high school, the Intifada was still active and the universities were shut down, and so I had to basically travel abroad to seek higher education. But the Jerusalem of the time also was a Jerusalem of hope, because I think we had a lot of hope that the Intifada was going to lead to some sort of peace settlement. It was a time when the Israeli peace movement was quite active, and we had hoped that this would lead to two states with Jerusalem as the capital of Palestine, or East Jerusalem as the capital of Palestine. And it was a hope that through a historic compromise, by giving up the dream of all of Palestine, we'd at least save some bits of it, or some remnants of it. So the Jerusalem of my past is the one that I decided to leave and very much hoped to return to. It's a city that I deeply loved, but I think later on I realized that I also somewhat resented, because it was not a happy place. It just was not a happy place. So that's about, what about my present? It's a city that I can visit so far. And that could change after tonight. That's why I wasn't sure about this video recording thing, but anyway. But I cannot live in. And I can't live in it because my wife is from Hebron. She's from the West Bank, and is not allowed into Jerusalem except through special and short-term permits. This is where my neighborhood has been divided in half by a concrete barrier which divides families and communities. just wear this in the summer. This summer, I was too young to be allowed to worship at the Aqsa Mosque. I had to be over 50. I'm getting there, hopefully. It is a city that is under the control of an oppressive matrix, which consists of checkpoints, fences, walls, military towers, and cage-like crossing points. The matrix also includes many other pressure points, from municipal taxes to house demolitions, lack of access to education, and housing. My father resists in a very interesting way. He just doesn't pay parking fees. Like, he's like, I'm not going to pay parking fees to the Jerusalem municipality. So he actually fakes the sticker and puts it on his and gets away with it. It's amazing. So, you know, people find ways of resistance. You know, he's in his 70s, so this is appropriate for him. but what used to be the city of Al-Quds, or the holy city, or Arab Jerusalem, has been turned into ghettoized and impoverished neighborhoods, separated from their natural continuity in the West Bank by the wall, and from each other by a strategically placed network of roads and highways, often built on confiscated lands. But also, again, a city of hope, because I think people are rediscovering their own power. And I had a chance to witness this past summer when I was there visiting, when really so we saw an unparalleled actions of civil disobedience and peaceful protest, when the Palestinians of Jerusalem, Christians and Muslims, protested security measures that were going to be imposed on Al-Aqsa Mosque. And in their thousands held vigils outside the mosque, refusing to enter it under Israeli, under the newly imposed restrictions. And though in those crucial weeks of July 2017, a sense of community was emphasized, solidarity, and yes, accomplishment. And I really can't think of a time when the Palestinians were pushed back to a point where the government of Israel would actually retract and take a step back. So this brings me to the future. The Jerusalem of my future may not be free. I don't think I'm young enough to see it as a free city. But I think it will be a city of resistance and resilience. It will be a city of self-reliance, of community. It will hopefully deprive the occupier of his power through the power of peaceful protest and civilian non-cooperation. It will have friends. It will have allies. It will inch ever closer towards its freedom. So we have to be thankful to President Trump because he brought us together. I mean, otherwise we wouldn't be here. And so bad people are so good at bringing good people together. It's just amazing, right? And the Palestinian novelist Ghassan Kanafani wrote Al-Mu'jiza hiya dhalika al-janin al-ghareeb alladhi yulad min rahm al-ma'sa. Miracle is that, you know, strange, unlikely birth that comes from the womb of tragedy. So from the womb of tragedy, we were here. So hopefully... this is a good thing, so maybe we should thank him. But anyway, his announcement, again, won't change much. It will embolden, if anything, the occupation, but it will also hopefully embolden us to come together and stand together. So finally, I'll just conclude with quickly on you know, what sort of Muslims believe about Jerusalem. When the Muslims first were commanded to perform 5 daily ritual prayers, if you see Muslims pray, they kind of stand together in rows and lines and pray in one direction. And that direction used to be the direction of Jerusalem initially, of Al-Aqsa Mosque. And then that direction was later changed to the mosque in Mecca. Further, Muslims believe that the Prophet Muhammad miraculously traveled overnight from Mecca to Jerusalem and was greeted at Al-Aqsa Mosque or at the site of that mosque by the prophets who came before him, from Adam through Abraham, Jacob, Joseph, Moses, and Jesus, and many others, and he led them in prayer. And this demonstrates that Islam looks at itself as an affirmation of the previous traditions, but at the same time as kind of charting a different course and a unique course. But so Jerusalem would symbolize for us the capacity of different faiths, different prophets to come together and coexist and thrive in a relationship of mutual support and understanding, and as we say in Islam, and God knows best. Thank you.
The final speaker is Fadi Inab, a Palestinian Christian born and raised in the Middle East. He teaches a course on migration at the University of Winnipeg. He holds an MA in sociology from the University of Manitoba, focusing on the history of police violence against Indigenous peoples in the Canadian provinces, and informally volunteers in the community, and is an advocate for and with newcomers and migrants.
So I'm born in Dubai to a Palestinian Christian Arab father. My father moved from Jordan, but before that he's born in Jaffa, 1946. Before Israel existed, there was a British Mandate of Palestine. In 1948, what they call independence, my father's family, my grandparents, got the shaft. They became Jordanian citizens. After 12 years, he moved to the Emirates for oil. It's like moving to Calgary here. So yeah, getting a call and your dad answers it, that his dad died and he can't go see him. 15 years before that, his mom dies and he can't go see him. So that as a child, you grow up with your father's social illness in the form of addiction to substance use, in the form of family separation, in the form of living away from home with limited rights, with limited mobilities. I'm born in Dubai, but I'm not a citizen of Dubai. They don't give me passports. So I can go visit my family. I can't go, at least part of my family. My family got fractured. My mom is in Dubai and my dad is in Jordan. After 50 years of living in Dubai, he gets kicked out because if you don't own a business, you're supposed to retire somewhere else. So even though a lot of the Palestinians built a lot of the Gulf countries, we have limited rights. So yeah, I might blame Israel today, but I'm also blaming the Arab countries. I'm also blaming the U.S., Canadian imperialism, etc. So don't think I'm just taking one side here. But you have questions that you can ask me about anything. But yeah, watching my dad's issues, trauma, dispossession, isolation... and now you study about Indigenous people's experiences in Canada, you see a lot of affinities and a lot of misrecognition of those realities. Responding to the U.S. Embassy announcement, what that also they're trying to imply is after announcing this, that Jerusalem is the capital of Israel, they're planning in the summer, this summer, to move the embassy. The U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem. This coincides with the 70th anniversary of the Nakba. So it's when you lose your land, you lose everything, and then you lose an icon of the heart of your city. So in a sense, it doesn't mean anything because colonization is ongoing regardless of Jerusalem. But at the same time, it means everything, literally everything, when a heart of your city, the body, is eroding. It's not a surprise that Trump came into power. Some of you might be surprised, but it's a settler colonial context. You'd expect that out of a settler colony that excluded indigenous population and had slave owners, a very proud slave owners. And I don't think it's about Israeli influence over the U.S., on its own. That sounds too conspiracy for me. I think there's a lot of movement within the U.S., within Canada, that supports settler colonization. And they see it as a continuation across the ocean, across the common wealth or common poverty. Depends how you see it. But yeah, it's a time of mourning, a time of reflection, a time of rage, to being angry about the continual injustice. Intifadas happened usually after the talks don't work, after intense feelings that not needs are unmet. So we can expect maybe there's another intifada happening, a third, fourth, fifth, sixth, until this injustice ends. That doesn't mean that you promote violence. You promote peace, but peace can be interpreted as violent if it's against a moving train called colonization. So I think Trump's announcement also kills the two-state solution. As the history showed here, that the two-state was supposed to be shared with Jerusalem being an international zone. So now when you're not sharing that, it really kills the two-state solution. But you could already argue that it was already dead when you look at the walls and all the other policies. Increasing settlements, limited rights for Palestinians, etc. But what he's making now is a one-state assimilative model. What we should be looking for is, I don't care if it's a one-state, three-state, two-and-a-half-state, as long as every citizen is included. Your civility is respected. Your dignity. So I think the issue is liberation from Israel, but it's also liberation to self-determination, to a nice open road that's inclusive for everyone. So there's some demands that people around justice call for. Palestinian right to self-determination. Sounds familiar, indigenous self-determination. Decolonization. That means ending occupation, ending checkpoints, ending the colonies, the settlements. Dismantling the apartheid wall. And some people are even saying that the apartheid is not even an accurate description because we even exceeded it. South African apartheid, at least it's rationalized using the people. We're trying to push the people out. And if we don't push them out, we kill them while they're there. If it's not physical, it's through social death. You don't talk about your culture. You don't talk about your background. I'd love to sit, have coffee with my grandparents before they died. I'd love to know about their history, their parents, their generations. But if my history is neutered, I just know certain things. What's been said, what I know about Palestine is from the outside. I'd love to go like you tourists. My other demands is the full equality of Arab citizens of Israel, because we continue to push them away. Not just those in the West Bank and Gaza and outside, but also the one in Jerusalem. Which brings me to the outside now, the right of return for refugees. The more you keep them out, the more they're going to increase. So if you think it's already too much and it's going to change a demographic shift, but you can control people regardless of the demographics. There's a lot of minorities out there who control power. You don't have to have just the physical bodies. It's also about what power you have. We need to end settler violence across our borders, from Canada to the Houthi. The deaths in Syria today, it's continuing. Before it, Iraq, Jerusalem, all those nice Arab cities. It's a replication, and it's hard. What unites us with the newcomer Syrians is about mourning and loss. I hope it also becomes about return and love. And not that we don't have that, but we also want justice. And must to be open to difference, regardless of faith, as long as it's open to land, relationships with the Creator, with others, to be open to difference, not just about what you wear and what you do, what you practice, but also how you feel to the land, to injustice. To end there, I just have three letters, BDS. Boycott, divest, and sanctions against Israel until the colonization ends. If you think it's just, why is it just Israel, then I'll also be the S Canada until indigenous people have self-determination here. But I'm not sure how most Mennonites feel about that one. But you might be good with Palestine, but I hope you're good also with the indigenous people. And speaking of good, I hope you realize that what killed the Jews weren't the bad people. It was good people the banality of evil that Hannah Arendt wrote about. It was so widespread that it seemed that it was business as usual sometimes. That's what we should be really careful about, to stop normalizing oppression.
We just heard presentations from Rabbi David Mifaser, Idris El-Bakri, and Fadi Inab at the event My Jerusalem, responding to the U.S. Embassy announcement from February 2018. The moderator for the evening discussion was Joanna Hebert-Bergen, MCC representative for Palestine-Israel. She reads a few questions from the audience to the panelists. Here is an excerpt from the evening's Q&A discussion.
Question number one, do you believe Trump's decision is positive as it removes the charade of the peace process? We'd like to tackle that question.
Sure, if you're optimistic and you want to see something positive in everything in the world, then I would say yes, because at least now I don't have someone hiding behind sheep's clothing, and he's a wolf, and we call him a wolf, and so that's what a wolf is, and whatever those, so yeah. So I could say, yes, it can be positive. But at the same time, it's so negative when there's all these extreme elements in society, and now you have someone giving them horns and whistles and guns and bullets. Even the school teachers apparently need to hold guns. God forbid now a Palestinian kid with a keffiyeh walks to school and someone thinks something of them. But yeah, and succinct.
I think it may have helped in one way, in that it just, you know the Naked King story, right? It exposed the nakedness of the Palestinian leadership.
That was my next question. What about Abbas?
Sorry, guys, if you get offended, to the Palestinians here, but Mahmoud Abbas has been basically, for him, it seems that negotiations is the strategy. Just negotiate. Just get invited to the table. And that's not working. And I think even he now is saying, and I don't know if it's just rhetoric probably, but that the U.S. is no longer an honest broker. I don't think it ever was an honest broker, to be honest with you. But I think it has just exposed to the Palestinian street the reality that we're stuck, and we have also work to do on the inside, mm-hmm. to sort of bring forth a different leadership, young leadership that's committed, that's authentic, and that's not beholden to the interests of the Israeli occupation.
In fighting settler colonial attitudes in both Canada and abroad, how do we educate without alienating? That's also one of my burning questions.
Fine, I'll fill up the silence without monopolizing discussion and the mic here. You start as young as possible, and you make sure that the education is there even after you die. That means there have to be archives of memory, archives shared by the public, not by state narratives, that continues to promote justice and inclusion. If it's about education, then you need to include lived experiences of those who suffered the consequences, not in a superficial sense, but in an empowering sense, and to recognize that every one of us have responsibility. A moving train that's going to come, and you can't be neutral on a moving train that's going to a violent place. You either stop it, but if you're just sitting on it, you're complicit. So back to the education, it needs to be throughout all society, throughout groups, and have more of the voices represented.
How do you?
I don't have any brilliant ideas, but I think you got to take the risk of alienating people. Mm-hmm. You gotta have some stamina. I think Canadians are nice people. They don't want to offend, but I think sometimes you have to be able to be willing to offend somebody because they just won't see the truth. I think we do ourselves a disservice. In, you know, a lot of good people have very, like, they're secretly pro-Palestinian, right? Like the closet Palestinian, right? They just doesn't come out because they're afraid of offending Jewish friends or maybe church friends or what have you. And maybe also afraid of being labeled anti-Semitic, which is a serious charge. And but I think we've got to get out of this sort of. You know, this is not about two cousins who are having a fight, and you're just saying we're both good cousins. You know, like there is asymmetry here. There is power on one side. There is dispossession on the other. And we've got to call it what it is for us to be able to start to even educate people, to try to say they're both. You know, about the same, we just got to get them to play nice. I think there's a lot more to it than that.
Yeah. Just hearing that question, what would alienate someone? Why would they be alienated? And I think to blame people or to talk about people as being guilty would alienate them. They'll make it really hard for them to listen to the message. So I wouldn't want to blame people, but to talk about people's responsibility is different than their blame. Like, not, I feel like in a society like we live in, we are all responsible. We're not guilty. I don't feel like I'm guilty of, like you've referred many times, the treatment of Indigenous people in Canada. I'm not guilty of what goes on, but I'm responsible for what goes on. So I would try to create education that would hold that distinction between guilt and responsibility. And another thing, I just think so much education comes from like lived experience, and try to create experiences for people or highlight experiences for people where you're living in the world that you want to have exist and enable people to experience that more so than talking about it so much.
Just a minor point. I mean, I share responsibility like David, but I mean, I also share the guilt. So I do feel I'm guilty to what's happening to Indigenous people. As a newcomer settler, I'm also guilty. I lost my land and now I have a home and I'm paying taxes and I'm having pension and all that jazz. Like, so I am guilty because there's Indigenous people who are homeless, who are dispossessed, like some of my own family members back home. So in that sense, I am guilty and responsible for what's happening here too. It doesn't mean I'm the one who originated the guilt, but now I kind of share it by default. That's why it's important to be clear about our land here, not just over there. Some of us escaped the inner city here to fly over east and solve other people's problems, but we should also solve the problems here. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Good.
Thank you.
We just heard audio from the talk, My Jerusalem, Responding to the U.S. Embassy Announcement, recorded at the University of Winnipeg's Eckhart Gramaté Hall Auditorium on February 28, 2018. Speakers were Esther Eptisen of the Mennonite Central Committee, Rabbi David Mivasser, Idris El-Bakri, and Fadi Inab. The audio of the talk was recorded by videographer Paul S. Graham. The unabridged video recording can be found on the Paul S. Graham YouTube channel. Music was by Purple Planet Music. More selections are available at the site www.purple-planet.com. The Global Research News Hour will return next week with more special summer programming. My name is Michael Welch.